Actually, it's afternoon. But
I hope it's afternoon. If it's still morning, a long day.
Okay. Not that I mind getting a promotion. It'd be a little closer.
Hey, how are you?
Is it closer? You guys,
the blue light, the PA's on.
Yeah. He was here this morning.
Call the House Interim Committee on Healthcare to order.
Really, really.
And ask for a. I will recognize Representative Notes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Open an organization meeting. Who are you?
I'm Representative Notes.
Oh, okay. I recognize Representative Notes.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 28, 2015.
Representative Notes moves to adopt the committee rules dated 9/28/15. These are the basic rules that we had in past sessions. Is there any change in rules?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Should we introduce the committee again? Everybody knows who this committee is, but yeah. By the way, Representative Clem, you look familiar. Will you introduce yourself?
He does.
Yeah, I'm Brian Clem, and you're all in my district. Welcome to District 21, heart of Salem, and over to the east side.
Hi, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, House District 46, which is parts of southeast and northeast Portland.
Sandy Teeley, Circus Staff.
I'm Mitch Greenock, House District 33, Chair.
Rob Nose, House District 42, which is southeast and a little slice of northeast Portland, and I'm one of the vice chairs.
Bill Kennemer, State Rep from District 39, which starts at Charbonneau, goes through Canby out to Estacada, and back through Boring, Damascus, and Happy Valley, and the outskirts of Oregon City. So.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
You even have a ferry in your district, right? That goes
I even
across
have
the river?
A ferry in my district,
that's
yes.
Right.
I can't top that, but I'm John Lively, House District 12, which is Springfield. That's pretty easy to drive.
The Millers.
Yeah. I don't have a ferry boat, but I have bridges that serve as a
well,
very
I've got
similar
some bridges,
function.
Yeah.
Concepts.
Okay.
And before you go?
Yes, ma'am.
I want to do my due diligence, as requested by our manager, Committee Services. The 2015 summary of legislation is available online. There's a sample of cover pages there. On the back side, it's got the table of contents. And then there's just a sample of the summaries. I also put a little flag piece of paper on it that's got the location of where the summaries are located on the webpage. And if anybody wants a hard copy, let me know. And we'll try and accommodate you.
I would like one.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who is this stranger?
It's Che Guevara.
Oh, my goodness. I hear he's a bulldozer driver, so I forgot it.
I'm trying to get a job with a Lund Report.
All right, that's enough of this. Wow. Stuff. Who the heck are you?
Ed.
Senator Caden, State Representative from House District 7, Vice Chair of Healthcare Committee.
Thank you, Senator.
That was fantastic.
Are you sure?
I will, under announcements, just comment. The work group on drug prices had its first meeting. My colleagues on both sides of me here did a great job managing a group of 50. Maybe 50 people. Yeah. We have created a formal work group that's a little smaller, 15, 16, something like that.
Something like that.
And the list is on OLIS. I have it up here in case anybody hasn't seen it. And you'll be meeting once a month from now on for a while, is that right?
At least, yeah.
Yes.
Initially once a month.
I think we've landed on the third Thursdays of every month.
Here in Salem.
In Salem. Good. All right.
Did you want to read that or not?
So as long as you read it.
Okay. The final work group participants are Jim Thompson, Tom Burns, Robin Richardson of MOTA, Thea Zajac of Leukemia Lymphoma Society, Luis Rodriguez, American Cancer Society, Jesse O'Brien Osberg, B.J. Kavnor, 1 and 4, Tom Holt, Cambia, John Bartholomew, AARP, Inga Deckert, Kaiser Permanente, Jessica Adamson, Providence, Jim Gardner, Pharma, Rocky Dallum, Oregon Biotech.
Okay, thank you, Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Have fun, guys. It's a really important job you're doing. I will close the organizational meeting and announcements. Well,
could join us.
I had heard you were excused. Welcome. You want to introduce yourself?
I was hanging outside the door there. And
get him a name tag now.
Fashionably late, State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, representing Yamhill and Washington County.
Jim, thank you.
I need some caffeine.
I'm going to open an informational meeting. We're going to talk to the Oregon Health Authority folks. We have several topics on the agenda. We've got some time to handle that, so if you would come forward in whatever order you want. We'll start with the rate stuff. Is that...
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Lori Coyner, Director of Health Analytics for the Oregon Health Authority.
Good afternoon. For the record, Zach Gatters, Senior Actuary for Optimus Consulting.
Great. Go for it.
Representative Greenlick and the committee, I'm here to give you a background on the current redevelopment of the 2015 CCO capitation rates. And I'm going to start off with just some opening remarks about why we are where we are. And then I'm going to turn over some of the methodology description to Zach, and we'll be happy to entertain questions either along the way or at the end at your discretion.
I think we've got time, so I think if anybody feels like interrupting for a question along the way to make sure the individual points are clear, that would be great. You're welcome to do it. I would suggest you just go ahead and do it.
Okay. You sure?
Positive.
Okay.
Temporarily.
So we embarked on a redevelopment of 2015 rates in early April, and the Oregon Health Authority contracted or at least expanded our contract with Optimus to as the actuarial firm that would help us in a redevelopment of the 2015 rates. So part of the purpose of that was we had increased scrutiny from CMS, and that's due primarily to the 100% federal funding of the ACA expansion population. So you'll recall in 2014, we received about over 360,000 new members onto the Oregon Health Plan. I'm going to refer, Zach and I will refer to those as the ACA expansion population, but they were unique in that we had little to no information about them before they came onto the plan, and they are 100% federally funded. So across the country, CMS has increased scrutiny in the actuarial soundness of those ACA rates, as well as implementing new guidelines about how those rates are to be calculated. We used a prior methodology through 2014 that was what we called in-house the cost template methodology. CMS provided us a notice of a corrective action in July of 2014 and said that we needed to use a new methodology to compute the rates. That new methodology was completed in late fall of 14, and the coordinated care organizations then sent a letter to the former Governor Kitzhaber with concerns about those rates. Based on that feedback and a very long list, 103 questions on those 2015 rates, Director Saxton convened the CCOs, and the decision was made to redevelop the 2015 rates. Advance the slide. The primary concerns that were outlined by the coordinated care organizations about the original 2015 rates were fourfold. One was that they were developed without, in a black box where they did not have an opportunity to examine the methodology. The second was that they were concerned about the unexplained variance between the CCOs, particularly for coordinated care organizations that were in the same region. Third, they wanted to have more input into the process of rate development. And finally, they were concerned about actuarial soundness. So in the new methodology that Zach's going to walk through, we paid particular attention to these points to increase transparency, involve CCOs throughout the process, and ensure that the rates are developed in an actuarial sound manner and that minimize unexplained variation between the coordinated care organization rates.
Can I interrupt for a minute? You originally gave the CCOs a 2015 rate that was designed in some way. This is a question of recalculating the 2015 rate, going backwards, not necessarily going forward. Is that right?
Chair Greenlick, that is correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess just following up on yours, yes. So clearly it was retroactive rather than...
Well, it will be.
Yeah.
Okay. The prospective calculation retroactively applied. I think
there we go. Right. Thank you. That's the clarification I was after.
Chair Greenlick, yes. And let me speak to this just shortly, and we will probably have more time to discuss it once we've heard from Zach. But CMS largely dictated our decision to make those payments retroactive to January 1st, and that was due to their concerns about the original rates that were submitted and their actuarial soundness and their willingness to approve those. So
we will talk about that after. Well, let's keep going with this.
Go ahead. So I'm going to turn it over to Zach to talk more about specifics of the methodology that we've used for the redeveloped rates.
Thank you. So before we get into the details of the methodology, I want to touch base on actuarial soundness. It's already been mentioned a half dozen times since the beginning of this conversation, and I think it's important for everyone to understand what's meant from the perspective of certifying rates. And in fact, what actuarial soundness is, it really just means that the actuary that's certifying the rates has followed a certain guidelines, actuarial standards of practice, which are we are bounded to professionally, and in addition to that, has incorporated all emerging information that's been available. What it is not, it's not just a data-driven process. And I think that's another important aspect of this that I want to make sure we're clear on. We do ask for claims information and encounter information, clearly, to help understand the baseline. But we also ask for the total financial picture from all the CCOs, which is part of the rates being actuarially sound from our perspective. We have to know what their total financial picture is, and we spend a large amount of time having conversations with each CCO to make sure that not only do we understand their business model, but we understand all of the incentives and other payments that fall outside of encounters and claims.
It says something different than what you just said. You said it's not a data-driven project, and your slide says it's not a budget-driven process. Is that the same thing?
Chair Greenlick, committee, yes, it is very similar. And let me just go back and talk through what is meant by it's not a budget-driven process. actuarial sound, if you follow all of those protocols and guidelines that I just mentioned, really is all about evaluating risk. It's about looking at internal and external influences on your program that will help the state evaluate the risk that any one CCO has for the various populations. So when I say it's not a budget-driven process, basically what I'm saying is we don't set out with a predetermined outcome. What we're asked to do is evaluate the risk of the Oregon Medicaid program. We report that risk, and then we work with OHA to understand how that maps to any type of budgetary restraints that may be in place.
Well, you may not consider it an issue, but we do. I mean, we have a budget for the Medicaid, and it seems to us, from our naive perspective, that that's the beginning of the process, and the question is how you distribute that budget. I mean, you can't independently do the rates and then come up with rates that are twice the amount of money we have to pay those rates. So, I mean, in that sense, it is a budget, or at least a budget-constrained process.
Chair Greenlink, I can't disagree with you that certainly there's the budget perspective, but I think the nuance here is that in order to help you understand your program, you need to know if you do have that issue where that if their expenditures are exceeding any type of less sustainable growth, that you understand that it is, and then therefore we dive in and try to understand what's the drivers behind that so that it can be corrected in the future. Furthermore, we do, part of the rate process that we'll get into, we are very much driven to matching payment to risk, where we do evaluate the risk of each CCO, and to the extent that a percentage sustainable growth per se is chosen, we then allocate that to each of the CCOs based on that risk that's been developed through the rate setting process.
We can get back to this, and we will get back to it later, but our basic notion when we designed this was that the issue would be to have a budget, increase it by no more than 3.4%, and then use risk adjustment to fairly distribute that budget among the 16 CCOs based on the risk of their population. If that's not a correct assumption, I mean, if it's you aren't correct. Working on the same assumption we were working on when we designed it, that's going to be a problem.
Chair Greenlink and the committee, OHA works closely with the actuaries, so they are telling us where the program is, and they are certifying rate ranges. So then it gives us the opportunity to look for the budgetary impacts within a rate range. So Zach certifying not a specific point estimate or PMPM, but a rate range. And that gives us the opportunity to establish what, the sustainable rate of growth within that rate range, or at least close to it.
Let's go forward now.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, but I just want to follow up a little bit further on this, because I do think this is the issue of contention and one that we have a lot of discussion about. I guess the piece that I didn't understand is that you said would be corrected in the future, and I think those were your words, corrected in the future, but actually the way this worked out, we corrected in retrospectively, which is both unprecedented and unbusinesslike, and frankly pretty untenable in my view, but I don't know. Am I missing something here?
I think it would be useful to go a little forward. It seems to me the question is, first we want to get a sense of whether the rate's right, and then we get into that very important political question you're raising, is whether it ought to have been readjusted in the middle of the year. That's really a huge question.
Well, yes, and I think that is a good question, but the other part is it's very unbusinesslike to adjust rates retroactively regardless of whether they're actuarially sound or whatever, because budgets have been set and expenditures have been allocated, and I see Mrs. Saxon is here, and maybe your director can help.
Yeah, we can have a little discussion about it, but let's continue with this first, if that makes sense.
Okay. this next slide really just sets the stage on exactly what we are thinking about when we embark on any type of rate setting exercise. And really, we refer to it as the four determinants of risk. And really, to boil it down, it's who are the members or the populations that will be receiving the services, what type of services will they be receiving regionally, where will those services be provided? And that's important for this program because there are 16 CCOs statewide. And depending on where there are in the state, that dictates a lot of the practice patterns and such that come through, and that needs to be considered. And then, of course, the delivery system. And again, I'll go back to my comment, delivery system comes into play here because you have 16 very different CCOs, and they deliver the care in very different ways. So the goals, as we set out, first and foremost, the first primary goal of this process was to be transparent. And we set up various touch points along the way, both in person and weekly calls, to not only share analyses, but to discuss methodology, solicit feedback from all the stakeholders. And in fact, that feedback was indeed incorporated in the final methodology that was chosen, and we found it to be very helpful as part of the process. As we continue into the existing rates that we're currently working on, which are 2016, that process continues where we have those meetings and touch points, again, on a weekly basis, and solicit feedback from the stakeholders as a whole. I mentioned the four rating regions. Actually, I didn't mention that there was four. I just mentioned the rating regions. There are four.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. I'm just a little slow today. So we've been touching bases on a weekly basis. Who touches bases with whom?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kennemeyer, I can explain a little bit more. We have... At the beginning of the process, it became clear that many of the coordinated care organizations had either an in-house or a consulting actuary who wanted to be able to weigh into the methodology. So we decided to hold weekly webinars. They're Fridays, where Optimus opens their models, no matter where they are, and talks about them in detail and asks for feedback. So that happened on a weekly basis. We hold a monthly rates work group meeting as well.
Excuse me, but how many are participating?
I can give you those numbers, but it's approximately 30 people on the call each week. We do track, and I can provide all of the who's attended for each webinar, as well as the rates work group meetings, which probably run about 50 participants. And then we've had over 100 individual meetings with CCOs since April. So that means either Optimus has come physically to Oregon. We've met one-on-one with each CCO four or five times for the 2015 rate redevelopment. And we've met one time on the 2016 rates. We will be meeting all of the CCOs Thursday and Friday to talk about the rate ranges for 2016. So it's been an ongoing process and a combination of individual meetings so that we can talk, you know, with each CCO on a personal private basis, as well as these open webinars on Fridays and rates work group meetings once a month.
Okay. So going back to the topic of the rating regions, we ultimately landed on four rating regions. This, in fact, was one of the areas where we solicited feedback from the stakeholders. Originally, we proposed three, but upon a productive discussion and an iterative process as far as the analysis, we landed on four. And the four that we chose as a group are shown on this slide. The regions really are split based on geography, but more importantly, what you don't see on that slide is there definitely is a difference in the way the care is provided between those regions. And the driver of that generally is the utilization of AB hospitals versus the DRG hospitals, which is important. Okay. This slide's going to get into some of the more nuanced portions of the methodology. And one of the, in addition to transparency, the second piece, the second goal of our approach was to explain any type of variance. We knew there was going to be variance. If you have 16 CCOs operating in a state, there's certainly going to be differences in risk across those CCOs for the same population. In fact, what we didn't know is the reason why. All we were could do at the time is just look at reports or summaries. So the goal was us to dig in and really understand what those differences were. And so the purpose here is to not get rid of the variance, but to get rid of the unexplained variance. And any variance that continues can be explained. The tool that we're going to use to do that, one of the tools, is going to be a risk score tool. It's going to be the CDPS plus RX tool. And really what that does, it looks at each member individually, their experience. It looks at their diagnoses. It looks at their pharmacy utilization. It assigns them a numerical risk score. And if each person gets assigned that risk score, you can then roll that up into what CCOs they belong to. And you can then get CCO-specific risk scores, and we have further examples to really drive that point home. But this gets to Chair Greenlich's comment, where the idea here is that if you start with that 3.4% increase, you need to make sure that you disperse that according to the risk of the population, and that's what we're attempting to do by incorporating this concept of risk score. This next page really just builds on that. So if we did not have a risk score, and in particular, this is going to be a real example, TANF population, which is one of your more traditional populations in Medicaid. And when I said variance still exists, if we did not apply risk score, for this particular region, this is the Tri-County region, which encapsulates family care and health share of Oregon, you could see that the regional rate came in at 317.53. Without any kind of risk mechanism, both entities would have received 317.53.
But that's subgroup of the population.
Yeah, this is just a one rating cohort, TANF population of your entire Medicaid population.
There are 13 different risks.
There are 13 different categories similar to this, yes.
Can you explain how those two entities, because this is a good example, they both operate in the metro area, why their risk scores would be different?
Yeah. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, we'll have a slide that I think will answer that question in a moment. So you can see that 317.53 would have been the regional rate. However, upon evaluation of the risk score, and again, I'll go back to the transparency, the risk score tool, the results, not only summary results, but the actual detail for each of the CCOs were shared with each of the stakeholders. So you can see that family care in this instance has a 0.94. 0.94 means healthier than the 1.0, so healthier than the norm. The 1.0 would be the norm for that particular region and cohort. Health share of Oregon obviously would have a higher acuity associated with it because they're the only two CCOs in that region, so when you would aggregate them, it has to get back to a 1.0.
Can I ask a question, Chair?
Please just ask, yes.
So, thank you. Can you please explain, so one is healthier than the other population. They're both from the regional area. They're both similar demographics, TANF population. Mm-hmm. You know, the obvious question would be, what if one organization is doing a better job of keeping their population healthier? So what are you basing those risk factors on? When you say health of a population, what goes into that determination?
It's a couple things. One of them is demographics. The tool actually has a demographic component, which will look at age and gender. And then the other component will be the diagnoses based, where it actually attributes members to more chronic illnesses. And that's going to be based on diagnoses that come through on the claims and also the pharmacy utilization that those members utilize.
Okay, so just to stop right there, you just said several things that raise the same kind of issues that were in the hearing earlier today. Mm-hmm. If some are prescribing pharmaceuticals more than others or are providing higher cost kinds of therapies, then it seems like that all of a sudden starts driving up the cost, and then you reimburse and we start getting going down the road toward a fee-for-service as opposed to the global budget keeping them healthy. So the way in which you...
It isn't about the nature of what they provide, it's about what risk we
exactly, but they're determining risk based on utilization of certain services.
It's not based on utilization, it's based on the existence of the disease.
Yeah. But you went beyond that and you said pharmaceutical assignments.
He didn't say that.
Yeah. So let me back up.
Okay, back up, because I was trying to listen to each of the different things that feed into that. And and the other piece of that is that you say you've provided that data, and I keep seeing heads shake in the audience. No, we weren't given that data. So I think that's at the crux of...
Yeah, let's not worry about what the audience is shaking.
Yeah, I know, but there's a discrepancy.
Let's worry about us shaking our hands.
Yeah.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer, we did provide the we've provided the risk score data at the patient or member level to each CCO, and we can provide documentation of that. So we went through rolled up summaries, but then when the CCOs asked to have it, and so it was delivered at a member level to each of the CCOs. Additionally, Optimus went through a couple different models. Mm-hmm. We got feedback from the during our actuarial webinars and the CCOs themselves to ask about what was better. If you go back one slide. And Optimus analyzed whether the increase in cost for a member was correlated or associated with the risk score. And the risk score was only applied for those cohorts or those individual groups where there is a relationship between the risk and cost. And that's important because we do see variation in members that have underlying disease, and they, between the CCOs, and then also it can be differentiated as well by age distribution within a CCO or gender. And so it's not utilization of services, but trying to understand utilization and those match those members to, the actual cost of providing them care.
Okay. You have a question, ask it.
Question.
Go ahead.
Chair Green. Thank you. Simple question, just on your calculation here, you said this balances to zero. So on this TANF population, is family care roughly twice the size as health share of Oregon?
Yes, one is substantially larger than
it's
the other.
It's the opposite, though.
Health share is roughly twice the size.
That's not related to the risk.
No. but then that balances to a net neutral then?
Because this isn't about budget or about your share of the population. This is just about, do I have more women who get pregnant versus single guys who are healthy? I mean, that's what this is about.
Yes. Within a smaller category, TANF is...
It actually averages to one.
Yes.
The risk itself averages to one within a region. That's a weighted average, the 0.94 and the 1.03, and when you put them together with their weights, they average 1.0. So it's simply differentiating, in this case, all the members of the region, which is two members. And it's based on the underlying propensity to consume services, not on how many services they actually use. And that's, the extent to which risk adjustment works, it gets under the utilization pattern and gets basically to the underlying propensity. Now, we need to see if it works or it doesn't work.
So, in another way to say it is, family care, for whatever reason, drew a healthier population of these randomly assigned TANF folks. They drew better cards in the lottery of this situation versus health share. Is that another?
That's what the data would suggest. And your question about how could it happen is an important one, which I think we'll get to.
So, excuse me. So at some point, I'm trying to understand the risk of the risk. So we're talking about this risk. What I'm trying to understand is, and I appreciate the factors that have gone into the tables, but given a comment you made earlier about when these people actually came into the pool and how much we knew about them then and how much we may know now, I'm concerned about the risk calculated on that short history.
Chair Greenlake, committee members, I think the important piece of this is to segment this rate setting process into rate setting for the expansion or the ACA versus the traditional or non-ACA. Your comment that you just made is more applicable to the expansion. We didn't know anything about them when the 2014 rates were set.
Right.
But what we're talking about right here is a traditional population that has been around since really the inception.
It's a very important issue, and yes. What I wanted to get to, which I missed in the meetings we had before, is this is only related to the pre-ACA expansion population.
That's correct.
And that was the one that was the big problem.
Yes.
I mean, the extent to which the government was asking you to do something, it's only the expansion population.
Right.
So this is all important, but it's on the 650,000 people, not on the 350,000 people, and I assume you'll talk about how you did that in a different way.
That's the last three categories of this.
That's three categories of the 13.
It's the last three categories.
Yeah. Okay.
But they're the ones that made the big difference.
That's the biggest difference.
Yeah.
This is the spot.
Soldier on.
This is where the slide is. The controversy is.
What
right?
Is it?
Yeah. Soldier on.
Okay.
Can you go ahead?
So we can come back to risk scores after we finish, because I think finishing the slides is going to add some perspective to the process. And like we just mentioned, there's a dichotomy here that needs to be recognized, ACA versus non-ACA, okay? And it's a very important one. The ACA rates, expansion rates, as I mentioned, and this is not unique to Oregon. It happened all over the nation. When the rates were set in 2014, the actuaries that were setting the rates had no data on those expansion individuals. There was a lot of theory out there, and you can go out and find the papers now about the theory, but the benefit we have now is we actually have emerging experience that put the theory to test. However, because of that, we had to come up with two distinct processes here when we're developing rates for your program. And let's talk about the non-expansion first. And we have already mentioned what we tried to do is match payment to risk by using a tested mechanism that's used not only in other Medicaid programs, but it's also used in Medicare, and it's also used in commercial rate development. So it's not a tool that Optimus nor the state has developed. It's a nationally recognized tool to actually accomplish matching payment to risk. What this table here shows on this slide, it shows that the shift that actually occurred between the ACA and the non-ACA. So, for example, in Family Care's case, I'm going to talk off the top, but both of these are fairly similar in the sense that the total ACA actually declines. Okay, the rates are being reduced, and I have a slide. The following slide is going to give you a little perspective behind that. However, what's more important on this slide is the non-ACA. It had actually increased. Not only did it increase, but it increased at a rate that far surpasses your sustainable rate of growth as defined by your existing waiver. Now, there are some drivers of that in discussions with the stakeholders and in our work that we noticed and brought to the table, one of which was mentioned earlier at the beginning of this meeting, which is pharmacy. Pharmacy costs are sky high, and there's a couple of different reasons, breakthrough therapy drugs for one, but also the increased cost of generics are no longer a safe haven to drive down costs. They're getting very, very expensive, and it's increasing the trend, and therefore it's going to have some sort of impact on how the rate of growth for these non-expansion members compares to the 3.4, which was developed back in 2012 or so. So the other component of this, and I mentioned at the beginning of this slide, but I'll reiterate that we, when you look at the expansion rates, it's actually a decline. Such a decline that it is somewhat, when you look at the numbers, that you have to wonder what was that rate and how did it shake out with the actual experience. What's driving, for example, the 29.8% reduction for the expansion? And before we get into that question, this is just another graphical representation of what actually occurred from statewide. I mentioned, think of the rate setting process as ACA versus non-ACA. And you can see for the non-ACA, overall, you have significant increase in rates. In the ACA, of course, you have a significant decrease. The weighted average, the bar to the far right, is fairly flat. So there was a somewhat of a subsidization going on behind the scenes. You know, once we took a deeper dive into the rates, it was clear to us that there was money that had been shifted over into the ACA cohorts that was taken away from the non-ACA cohorts. We found that out by evaluating the risk, like I started off the conversation with, which is what we were asked to do. The result of our rate setting actually shifted some of the funds back into the non-ACA, but took it away from the ACA. Again, it's just based on the whole idea of the very first slide. What we said was actuarial soundness is not setting rates with a predetermined outcome. So if you do set down that path, it may lead to some offsetting consequences, such as subsidization between the expansion and non-expansion in this case.
Can you explain? So I think you explained why there's such a wild swing, right? That's a pretty big swing, all right? Can you explain why there's such a difference between family care and health share?
Yes. So are you referring to the non-expansion, the TANF example?
I think I'm just looking at the slide up here. So, okay. You know, I mean, there, you know, one of the CCOs is, I think, you know, rightfully concerned about, you know, they're getting a, they had concerns about the rates at the beginning of 2015. Now they're seeing rates change potentially in the middle, and it looks even worse than when they were complaining back in January.
Yes.
And I'm trying to get my brain around how we can do that to them. And is it justified and why from your all's perspective? I think that's what I'm trying to understand.
Sure. Yes, I can speak a little bit about what is behind these numbers. I can speak to, we mentioned that we used risk score to apply to the non-ACA. But in fact, we did explore the risk score tool for the ACA as well. So we could see that underlying risk of those individuals to see if it supported this. We did not use that in the rate development. And the reason is because if you think, if 2014 is the first year of experience for this group, when what we did at face value, the experience is coming in far short of what was expected. However, when you look at the average duration by definition is the number of months individuals been enrolled in a program. And what we know is that the longer individuals are enrolled in a program, they learn how to navigate that program. And therefore, the utilization potentially will increase over time. And what we found was that the average duration for the ACA was generally around 4 to 5.5 months, very, very short. But you would expect that because a lot of them were just being phased into the program in 2014. You compare that with your non-ACA, TANF, for example, and the average duration is commensurate with something 9.5 to 10.5 months out of the year, which is really more norm. Because of that low duration, it would have been... It potentially subjected the process to bias because you would have been basing a risk score on a population that only had 4 to 5 months of enrollment. Mm-hmm. So we did not do that. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we actually took the reported expenditures from each of the CCOs. When I say reported expenditures, it's not just the expenditures associated with encounters or claims. Again, it's their total financial picture. that's associated with the expansion population. So in this case, you can see the family care, the reported PMPM for 2014 was 233.10. That's a reported number that was provided to us via financials. It's nothing that we've calculated. The premium that was paid in 2014 for this population was $516.08. Now, again, I want to reiterate, those rates were set with no data, and they were set with a conservative mindset because no one really knew. Everyone was afraid of the population because it was expected to inflate the roles of a Medicaid program significantly, and it could bankrupt a program if not considered in totality as far as being conservative when you set those rates. That's what's happened here. That's where CMS and the federal government have gotten involved. And looking at this, they knew that the rates were set with no data. So what they did is they produced a lot of guidelines and said, states, as you get emerging data, we would like you to incorporate them in your rate development and true them up as necessary so that payment better aligns with risk. Now, what we did is we started with the reported expenditures. But my comment earlier was that you need to be careful and not take 2014 at face value because it can mislead you. Because the 233.10 is a fairly low number when compared to the premium that was received. And in fact, upon our durational study, looking to see that it was 4 to 5 months of duration, we actually account for that and we inflate that number 5 to 10% higher just because of nothing more than an increased duration for the members, assuming that as they will learn how to use their benefits at a faster rate in the next contract period. So you can see off to the right the calendar year 15 rate that was ultimately set that goes along with the 233 and the 516 is 362.14. Is there a question?
How can it be then that family care has such a much lower rate than health share? Wouldn't there two ACA populations, if you don't have any experience, I hope I'm saying this right, I'm not an actuary, wouldn't they need to be similar? I mean, they're
not necessarily. You can see off to the left, I've been talking off of the aggregate or the total ACA. Okay. Which is the bottom line.
Yep.
But as you can see, there's actually three subpopulations. And if you look at the age bands associated with those, this gets to one of the questions earlier about risk score. What drives that? Certainly, we could all agree that a 50 to 54-year-old male would be riskier than a 20 to 24-year-old male just because of the demographics. And that's what's going to happen here. That's one aspect of this, is that the mix of individuals, just based on demographics alone, is going to drive a difference in the potential risk. And so that's going to be one component. The next component of this is just really going to boil down to general law of insurance, which says 20% of your population makes up 80% of your spend. And that's true pretty much in all insurance. It's why insurance exists. So we actually, if you think about what that means, is if you start taking that 20% that's really the driver of the expenditures and you start carving that up, it's not likely that each entity, managed care entity, or in this case CCO, ends up with the exact same distribution of those 20% of individuals, which is why
the age distribution is basically the same in the two populations.
It's very close, but I will say that the factors associated with those age groups increase exponentially. So even if the average age is off by 1 to 3 years, it has significant impact on the risk.
Can I say something, Chair?
Go ahead.
So what you just said a few sentences ago about how, and I love family care and health share, so this alone doesn't say whether one is performing better than the other. We're only talking about inputs and not outputs, mm-hmm. or health outcomes at all, which is, you know, a challenge because we're still very early on in the process, and that's really the meat of all this. But just in terms of the inputs, So Family Care spends an average of $233 per member per month for the total ACA population, and Health Share is $291. And what I understood you to say, which is similar to what you said earlier when I asked the question, was that part of the risk approach and part of the rejiggling of this is that you look at what they were given and what they spent, and one is a lot less than the other. And so, as such, why let them take home all that money? Let's fine-tune it and reduce it something closer to what they've paid. The question is, and what many people in the community are saying, is that that kind of reformulating leads people to think, oh, well, those that have higher expenditures are going to get more per member per month, and it starts driving in that direction. So the concern is, and there's no way to know from this whether one has a better than the other. If they're It could be they're putting more into population-based strategies and keeping a healthier population and not having to spend as much. That's what we'd like to see. It could be that one spends less because they're not getting out to as many people and not serving their population as well. There's no way to know with the numbers. So I'm not asking this with any bias. I'm just saying that the calculations that go into this that are based in part on what they've spent per member per month in the past, in my view, is not a good reflection of what it should be in the future. I feel like we're doing this really early in the process, not knowing what the outcomes are. There's no outcome in how we're keeping people healthy that's in this, you know, in this calculation at all. So a lot of it is based on...
Let me add to that question. I think it's clear, I believe, there's the big fallacy in the 2015 rates of the ACA population because of many of these issues. I don't really think that the past experience... The past expenditure is the right relationship. But my assumption is that your 2016 rates will not do it that way, right? In the 2016 rates, you'll use the risk-adjusted model for the whole population set?
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. I'm sorry.
No, I...
Okay. The intent here is that in 2016 that we continue down the path, the methodology that's been set forth, because, which would imply that we don't use risk adjustment for expansion because of the issue that I just mentioned. We don't have any new data that we didn't have when we set 2015. If we use risk adjustment for the 2016 rates, we're going to be applying risk adjustment in some cases on members that don't even have 6 months of membership in the program, which means that their risk score could be biased or skewed, become not credible.
But then that's going to really give credibility to the problem that Representative Kenny Geyer raises. I mean, I think we all have real problems with using the expenditure data for the population as an estimate of risk rather than using the underlying phenomena.
Well, there is no new data that's out there that we haven't used for the rate development. So if absent of any new compelling information that would indicate some kind of massive shift in risk, the change in the expansion rate is going to be very predictable. In fact, it's going to be the secular trend that we assumed.
Yeah, we have some real doubt about the use of the way after I met with you, I became quite satisfied that your risk adjustment model would work, and then found out you're not using it for a third of the population. You're using something much more questionable, much less
expansion. Balance. And again, we've actually ran the analysis for the expansion. And in a lot of cases, what we would show if we actually applied the risk score, that the increase would be even more severe than it is shown.
And I don't care about the answer. I care about the method.
As we do as well. But it's important to understand that using the risk score tool with not an appropriate number of months of duration is going to skew the process potentially more with using the tool.
Representative Greenlake and the committee, I want to address a few of the points that Representative Kenny Geyer brought up from a more of a policy perspective. So as Zach has described, we plan to use the risk adjustment tool, but likely won't have sufficient data until we undergo the 2017 rate setting process. I do want to bring up a couple points. So one of them is that CMS's guidelines require us for the ACA expansion population to use what's called emerging experience. What that means is use the expenditure data in order to calculate or to inform the rate setting. And because those dollars are 100% federal, we have to comply in order to receive those funding. However, we are engaging a process right now with a consulting firm, Manat and Optimus, and we will be bringing in the CCOs in a collaborative process to start to talk about how we move forward. So we see this 2015 process that we just underwent as a level setting, and you'll notice in that bar graph that we needed to do it in order to get the non-expansion rates up to where they needed to be and adjust the expansion rates because of the requirements from the federal government. But then moving forward, we need to really think about how to get to the a methodology that is in keeping with the global budget. But until you can't raise rates 3.4% if what your base rate isn't matching payment to risk. So we needed to level set. And then we need to have some serious discussions because we did see that the non-ACA population the expenditures were much higher than 3.4%, and that's a concern. So the next steps are to engage CCOs to talk about how we do that, to look work with Optimus to see if there are ways to reward efficiency. So where you're talking about CCOs who are providing good care for less, how do we reward that? Frankly, these methods aren't being applied anywhere in the country, and so it's going to take us the next 6 to 8 months of serious work to come up with an expanded methodology. We see this as the beginning and not the end to be able to apply to 2017. So I know there are a lot of concerns. We at the urgence of CMS needed to level set our rates, and then in many ways the harder work needs to happen where we can meet the spirit of the waiver and the idea of a sustainable rate of growth and marry this new requirement that CMS put in with their guidelines that were published in September of 2014 that require us to have actuarially sound rates that use financial data. So it's added complexity to our ability to compute rates that meet the global budget, but we think we can get there. It's just going to be some work.
Mr. Chair. So I can continue to have a problem. So this reported, the ACA, the 233 or the 291 was of August. But what I'm trying to understand, when we shut down last session, we had the CCO's report when they came in. And one of the things they talked about is the point at which people are coming in to the program, even though in theory, let's say January 1st. In some cases, we have CCOs that don't have enough physicians, so they're not even coming in yet because there's not a physician. So I'm trying to understand the impact that has on this cost per patient and how accurate that is to be able to base what the actual costs are, because in some cases, it isn't 6 months. Some cases, it's this much. I guess I'm not getting the connection between if we're going to use the cost per patient as that figure.
And Optimus took that into account with what Zach called the durational adjustment. So rather than setting the rates based on only what we saw happening right with the 2014 data, they added with the idea that there was going to be more utilization because of these reasons that you brought up. And so they added 5 to 10% to the rates on top of it, just with the, and that was not, they didn't just pick a number, but it was through analysis of how long people were on and then what they call, which we haven't discussed, penetration analysis. So how long have the new members been on? Oregon Health Plan, and then how many services did they use, and did that increase over time? you want to add to that?
Sure. The penetration adjustment is key here, because really what that boils down to, it gets to your comment, is would be the percent of the population that are receiving services. Right. So if there is some sort of access, that would be deflated. And in fact, that's what we saw, which is why we considered that. If you look at the, while we have to start off with the reported 233.10, mm-hmm. certainly the where we end up at 362 is much, much higher than the 233.10. And part of that is the durational adjustment of 5 to 10, and the other part of it is that we actually are projecting a much higher trend for the expansion population because of some of the reasons that you just mentioned.
Chair Greenlee, I've got a more generalized question here on timing and some of the work that we did in this last session. Looks like that you here in your health policy, you say that CMS responded in a formal letter on August 21st, 2015, regarding the development rates of, with the preference to do that in January 1st. Then when we read the letter, it says, okay, basically fine, you got to meet these requirements that you've provided here from CMS. But it also says that once the state submits its contracts and rate certification, CMS will review those in accordance with our standards. But we had put a requirement on OHA to have those available to CCOs within prior 60 days. And what I'm seeing here in this document is that you say the 2016 rates will be provided to CCOs for review, not less than 60 days prior to January 1st. I believe the intent of our legislation was not for review, but an executable contract 60 days prior to. So where is the miss there?
So
we were pretty specific about executable contract 60 days prior. What I'm seeing here is review 60 days, and we specifically wanted to avoid that.
Representative Greenlee and the committee, we submitted the for the 2015 redeveloped rates. We submitted those the certification and the rates went to CMS with the contract executable contract amendment on August 28th. The 2015 redeveloped rates went to with the contract rate sheets, and as far as an executable contract went to CCOs on, I believe, September 1st. It might be the 2nd. I would have to verify that for 60-day review. The 2016 rates we will, we're targeting right now to have complete on October 16th, and they will be, CCOs will be receiving executable contracts with contract rate sheets for 2016 by November 1st, and that will allow them 60 days to have those, and we will have CMS reviewing that concurrently.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Can I ask for clarification on that?
Why do you have a question?
Sorry.
Yeah. Representative Wyden, go ahead.
I've tried to contain myself for you, Mr. Chair, but I do have one simple question. I'll keep things simple. How many people are enrolled as of this date? The actual number, how many people are enrolled as of this date?
In Oregon?
Yes.
In the entire state?
Yeah.
As of this morning, 1.12 million people.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority.
Does that answer?
Yeah, that was it. Which is one of the actual number of what we had there.
And it's about two-thirds the old population, about one-third the so-called AC expansion population, which is 100% paid by federal government during 2015, but less than 100% paid by the federal government in 2016. Is that right?
Actually, Mr. Chair, that probably wouldn't be I'd forced to get kind of a breakdown of those numbers and everything, too. Of who's actually going on to the system. So, because this is over a third of the population, or about a third of the population.
Yeah.
It's on here.
Person King Geyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I just want to understand on the 2015 rates, they were given to the CCOs on September 1st for a 60 day review. Is that right? September, they're talking about the September 15th rates. Is that what you were saying? The 60-day review for the CCOs that started on September 1st, is that September 1st of 2015?
Yes.
For the 2015 rates?
For the 2015 redeveloped rates.
And so these are the ones that they get 60 days to review, but it's retroactive to January 1st. So if they're taking a huge cut and they've already spent money and they say, we can't do that. I mean, the purpose of a 60-day review was to look ahead and say, yes, we would like to enter this contract with you, or no, at this point, it's not going to meet our needs.
So we've there's been a memo that was released that has a schedule to have the either recoupment or the payments, because many of the CCOs are receiving more funding, to be completed by the end of calendar year 2015. However, a CCO that is for one reason or another is not able to have that completed by the end, or doesn't, it's going to be a hardship, they will contact us and we will work with them, and we can extend that recoupment beyond 2015. We did ask and for those CCOs that are receiving payments, they wanted to be able to complete those before the end of the year, so that for their financial analysis and books, and those that have to have a recoupment, then we're extending that process and going to work with them on an individual basis.
How much is the clawback number for any that have to give you back money?
I don't have that number with me, but we can get it for you.
You have the magnitude of that? Is it $1,000, $1 million, $100 million? You must have some idea.
We did work with Mark Fairbanks, the CFO's office, to look at both the financial impact overall, as well as the financial impact to the state budget. This is costing some of state dollars through our to increase the non-ACA rates. And as we were going through that process, we ensured that we still stay under the 2% test, which is part of our sustainable rate of growth.
I'm asking a simple question. You're asking family care and UMCO, I think, to give you back money. How much is that money that you're asking to give you back?
We can give you the I don't have the data with me. It was in the slides we submitted, so if you give us 15 minutes, we'll find it.
In the slides that we have in front of us?
Well, not in your slides, perhaps in the slides for this morning. We'll give it to you, and our CFO can get it for you.
Ways and Means. We have?
Yeah, I don't think we do.
You don't have any idea what the... Aren't you the main numbers person, always say? You can walk in here and tell me you don't know anything of the magnitude of that number. I find it hard to believe.
The analysis we made on the magnitude of the numbers was the reference I made in this morning's hearing, that we went back to them with each of their specific amounts and said, please notify us if there is any problem here. So I'd like to give
you... They've been notifying us. Thank you. The question is... What's the magnitude? You not literally, I mean, are you really, you're sitting there with a straight face and telling me you don't remember the magnitude of that number?
I don't have those numbers in front of me.
I'm sure you don't have them in front of you.
Representative Greenlick, I oversee the actuarial aspect of this, and then we worked with a finance that computed the total dollars that and the impact to each of the CCOs.
It was actuarial analysis that created that number. You developed that number as a part of the actuarial analysis. I'm trying to avoid bringing up CCOs, but I'll be glad to bring some up and ask them to tell me.
We have it. I just don't know each CCO's impact on the top of my head, and I don't have it in front of me.
I'm sure they know.
But it's in the order of millions.
Oh, let's keep going.
I know that the state budget,
don't know that we shouldn't ask.
The impact to the state budget was around $40 million, but I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I don't want to speak to it until I do.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I guess that would bring up one of my concerns, just hearing the numbers and everything.
So we have the numbers now.
Here's the exhibit, and I apologize.
Introduce yourself.
I'm Mark Fairbanks. I'm the CFO for the Oregon Health Authority, and I think the order of magnitude, Representative Greenlick, is between, let's say, $6 million and $55 million.
So you're asking somebody to write you a check for $55 million because you didn't give them the right rates at the beginning of this year? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, I think that that is going to be a function as well of not only the CMS guidelines and requirements, but also the actual in these slides, we also indicate the reserves and the liquidity profile for the CCOs. So I believe we did a sensitivity going out through the year using just the actual reported results, which is the best we had at the time, for the first quarter to go through the year to see some level of sensitivity to if we had these adjustments go to January 1st, what the impact would be on margin and what the impact would be given their liquidity and their reserves. And based on that analysis, as you can see in these graphs, it looked like it was a sustainable adjustment.
You have these in your packet. These are part of our submittal.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, that's it.
Right here.
Mr. Chair?
You have it, and it's online.
It's online, yeah.
Thank you.
While we actually still have the CFO up here, real quick.
Yes.
I guess they're looking at all of that. I guess this gets into something, and I brought this up on the House floor.
I remember.
But I brought this up even when we started this program on the House floor, is with the declining federal dollars, how are we going to pay for this? I mean, this is a small piece, and pretty soon the federal dollars are gone, and there's going to be no guarantee of federal dollars. How are we going to pay for this?
Wait, the federal dollars aren't gone.
No, I said
they reduce
they're,
the 90%.
They're reducing. I mean, we're just looking at the 10%, but there's no guarantee after 2020 of those federal dollars, and it could be 50% or whatever. So
we'll let the next
what is our plan?
Committee worry about 2020.
Well, what's the plan going forward? Because are we just going to shut everything down? So it doesn't make sense to me if we don't start planning right now for 2020 when there's no guarantee of federal dollars.
But, yeah, I can go ahead and respond, Representative Greenlick, and thank you for the question. There is a tool that we've developed, actually was developed before I arrived in late May, early June in this position. And so I apologize for my fumbling. I'm still a little bit of a new guy, and that's my bad.
Happy to have you here.
But the answer to the question is we really have looked hard at a sensitivity and built a model to look out over a six-year plan. So this biennium, the next, and the next. And by the way, the ACA is federally funded 100% for 16. It drops to 90% in 17. Okay. Then it goes down from there to, I believe, 2020. And correct. You know, our baseline sensitivity model would indicate that we're going to have in the next biennium maybe as much as a $490 to a $500 million issue. And that's based on a set of...
19.
Pardon me?
That's 17-19. 17-19,
yes, sir. So there are several levers that we would have to look at. Some of them have to do with how we our waiver strategy for the renewal of our waiver and how we are going to address transformation funding in dollars. Some of them will have to do with the fact that we have estimated that number based on no growth in the general fund. We've estimated that under a very conservative set of assumptions around caseload. So there are probably four or five levers that we're staring at right now, and hopefully we'll find more to ameliorate the issue and have a solid plan for filling the gap.
Including the gap in the hospital tax is one of the pieces that's
yes.
available.
That is one of the levers, yes, sir.
I'm sorry for pushing on it, Mr. Chair. It's just something, if we're not thinking about this, there's a lot of people that are going to get hurt.
I agree with you, and we do need to think about it, but I think we need to worry about 2015 and 2016 first. And
yeah.
So I want to just see if I can, I'm trying to look at which charts, and I think I have the one up, and so I'm just trying to understand if, because it says estimated change in rates retro to January 1st, and I'll start with the one at the top, says all color health care plans, it shows a $7.8 million deduction, and based on that deduction, though, it still says estimated, so I'm trying to understand, so that, to me, if I'm reading that correctly, says they owe, under the new rate system back to January, they owe $7.8 million. But yet, if I read this chart also, but it also says that they still have a 13% margin. I guess it doesn't make any sense to me what's going on here. I mean, you can see the $55 million, Jackson Care Connect is $10 million, and it's still a 3% margin. So that 3% is based on back to January, but not necessarily based on where they're going to end the year if they pay that money back. Is that correct? I mean, I don't...
Those estimated margins are based on projections given the new rates.
To the end of the year, mm-hmm. for the 2015.
Yes.
They are based on that.
And the reason that the amounts are estimated is that we have to project the member months or how, sure. you know, the enrollment. And so it's the best estimate now.
What percent of the 2015 rates is that $55 million for family care? Yeah.
Can you repeat the question, please?
What percent of the total payments in 2015 is that $55 million you're asking them to return? Is that 2% of their budget, 5% of their budget? I mean, of their expense, of what you paid them. You understand?
Right.
You understand the situation?
Yes.
Is that we have. We get the political blowback from these kinds of things. And nobody's come to us to complain about the fact that you're going to give them an extra $12 million. That has not been on our agenda. I haven't had to deal with those. But I have had to deal with people.
Imagine that.
Strange, but I have had to deal, and so is everybody else at the table, deal with people who say they screwed up in their rate. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. They notice we have some money in the bank, and they're coming after us, so we'll end up with zero balance because we have the deep pocket, and that's who they're coming after. And other, even more paranoid statements than that, and that's what we've all had to had to deal with in at least the two plans that have to give back the money. There's not a lot of question about the validity of your method for people who are getting money. Although I suspect when they get to 2016 rates, they might have a problem. So that's what we're dealing with, and that's why we're passing some of it back to you.
Yeah.
And Zach can sit there and pretend he's just a technician, and that's great. These are political questions we're asking now, not technical.
So let me just say a couple things here. And first, let me say thank you to the committee, because this is very hard stuff. It's very complex. It's not what you all spend every day dealing with. And it has created a tremendous challenge for you as policymakers, and it's created a tremendous problem for Oregon's health system transformation. So the piece that I want to bring forward is that, and I was drawing a chart here that we may bring back to you, which is what we want and what we have to do and what we're getting to have health system transformation in Oregon. And I want to underscore, because these people who've been working around the clock for 7 months are deep into the schedule and the requirements that CMS requires for Oregon. And I know and am committed to a global budget that allows us to transform healthcare. That's why we're all here. That's why we're working so hard. That is, quite frankly, why we redeveloped the 2015 rates, is we had to level set. The federal government and others said, you have to level set. You have to get on more solid ground than you are currently on. Now, for all of you and for me and for much of this team, that was a process and a set of rates that we inherited. We were not there. I was not there when this work was done. And so it is not optimal in any business sense ever to have a retroactive rate-making process, and we agonized over that. However, when we talked to CMS about could we just go back to here, their answer was a resounding no, and we can go into that in great detail with you. But we sign a contract with CMS for about $9.8 billion, and over the course of the last 2 years of the implementation of Oregon's health plan, they have changed the rules. They have changed the rules and I'm not blaming them. They have they've stood up the largest social program in this country since Social Security, and they've had a few surprises. We've had a few surprises. So I think, and we're getting the number you asked for, I want to be sure you know that. But I think the important thing here is we're very clear this is not optimal. We're very clear. The best business practice is 60-day notice so that the CCOs, who, we need to say this, are doing a remarkable job in very difficult circumstances, but so that they can go out and sign their provider contracts to drive healthcare transformation. And the easy choice for us, although it wouldn't have been an easy choice, would be to not redevelop 2015 rates and lay low and hope that things got better. Unfortunately, CMS had zero interest in that plan, and neither did I, because to your point, Representative Widener, we need to know where we stand financially every single day, or this program will not be successful for the most vulnerable people in our state. So we committed ourselves to a really complex process that required a lot of time and effort. I want to commend the 16 CCOs for leaning into the problem. If you'd like to hear from the CCOs who think the process went well, we're happy to bring them forward.
I just do it by the big numbers they get. They'll be the happiest.
Well,
this could be,
but,
based on how much money they get returned.
But there's a
down to the bottom when they're not happy.
Understood, but there is a methodology here that is the basis of those numbers. There is, and it is a sound methodology. We can talk about what you, the work that we have done for 2015. We're going to see on Thursday the 2016 rate ranges for all 16 CCOs. And my expectation is that we will have achieved our goal of moving forward to better stability in the system. And my personal goal, all of your goal, all of our goal, is to a system that allows us to continue to transform healthcare.
But Madam Administrator, here's where I am with that, and here's why I'm so worried about this process.
Yes.
I do not believe where you are going now leads us to the place where we can sustain transformation. I believe you saw that number, the raw increase for the existing population would be over 6%. We are committed to a 3.4% maximum budget, 3.4% per person increase year to year. I believe the only way that that's going to be sustainable in terms of what we have to tell the CCOs from up here is that there is a 3.4% budget increase. There is a fair methodology that distributes that total budget among all of you. And if you think there's not enough money to do the job, then you better figure out a new way to deliver health care to those people. But that discipline only works if they believe, or at least if we believe, that the methodology you're using is a legitimate methodology to fairly distribute the budget that we have, because the budget we have is all the budget we have. And that's why we're pushing on you so hard, because for a third of the population, I don't believe there's any evidence that is a sustainable way of calculating rates. And I cannot say to family care, don't worry, everything's fine.
No.
I mean, I say to them, I have said to them, don't worry, everything's fine on the existing population, but I can't say that based on any evidence that anything's fine, because we're not going to go forward to this. It's not where we're going with 2017. There's got to be something else, right? I mean, yeah, there does have to be something. I can answer my own question. But that's the problem we have, because we designed this system. We have to defend it, but it has to be a fair game.
Let me see if I can ask a question that would be helpful. At the core of that concern, is it that you believe that it is impossible to discern a difference between the populations of health share and family care? Is that?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
And I say that you may have done it adequately. I'm willing to defend the way you do it for two-thirds of their population, but I'm not willing to defend the way you do it for the other third. And that's what you're asking me to give back money on that other third of the population. Is that a fair game? I think it's nonsense. I don't think it's a fair game at all.
Zach, do you have any experience with other states in the country that would be helpful here in terms of moving forward with a sustainable number?
Well, I can speak to states that we're working in that expanded, and they're seeing the same phenomena, which is the original rates that were set were too high. and the federal government is requiring them to use emerging experience to level set those rates. That is what we have attempted to do in this most recent rate setting, and that's what's being asked across the nation for the various states. In fact, it's explicitly listed in the 2014 guidelines that CMS put out because of the expansion rates and because of their observations.
I feel like I want to say something that's politically incorrect, maybe, but it's direct, because I think it's part of what we're struggling with. I think the concern from family care is that, you know, they look very profitable relative to the rest of some of their peers, and then that with the other, because they're set up differently, they have a different business model than some of their peers do. They're being penalized. Like, they look like they are extraordinarily profitable relative to their peers when their peers have different ways of, they run their business model is done differently. And I don't have any way to, like, reconcile that, right? Like, they look very, you know, they look very successful, then they're getting a very large clawback, and that seems very unfair, and we're struggling to reconcile that, and they feel like partially they're being punished for their business model, which is they think these other entities, the other CCOs, probably are doing as well as they are, but it's not as revealed as clearly.
Can we respond?
Yes.
He's probably asked the chair.
Yeah, let me hold on a minute. We are way over time, and we're going to soon be over time.
Complex issue.
I want to get this question, and I'm glad we really have some time to deal with it. Yeah. I'm going to get this question, and Kenny Geyer's, and if there's maybe one other question, we'll get to it. So if you would respond to that, then I want you to spend a few minutes on the other issues.
Happy to.
So we'd be done maybe at a quarter to this.
Yep.
A quarter to four. Yes, go ahead. If you remember what his question was.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlick and the committee, I do want to come back and again apologize. I've got these numbers in front of me.
I think you better introduce yourself.
The impact. Mark Fairbanks, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Chief Financial Officer. The overall impact of the retro rates would represent less than 1% of total revenue for the CCOs at the same time.
For
family care, it would be 0.09%.
Less than 1%.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful. Go ahead.
So you wanted to respond.
Yes. Thank you. So in response to the question, it is a true statement that the two entities have very different business models. However, one key thing to remember in the rate setting process, the financial MLR does not capture.
I do want to correct my statement.
It can't be 1%.
No, it's but
that
it's,
would mean they have a $5 billion
right. It's 9%. My correction. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay,
it's a little over that.
Okay.
The financial gain loss that you refer to, or the various different business models that would reflect what you would see on a financial statement, is not taken into consideration directly in this rate setting. This is a result of us actually soliciting their expenditures as reported, having conversations with them to understand, to the extent that there are subcapitated arrangements, understanding the nuances with them, and then building the rate from there. So how they report through their financials with the related entities is not directly correlated with the base data and how these rates were calculated.
Thank you. I just wanted to build a little bit on what Representative Nose was saying. Two things. One is, in trying to understand why within one region the per member per month would be so much lower. And again, we hear this from CCOs across the state. It's just that the ones serving my constituents are the ones that I've paid the most attention to and the ones that I care the most about. I care about them all, but I want to make sure that the people in my region have access to good health care and different models. They're both doing great work in different ways, and I applaud that and would like to give that more of a chance. In 11 of the categories here, health share gets significantly more in 8 of them and a teeny bit less, in some cases pennies less, in the other 3. And so I would love to see what the different, like you have more pregnant women or more people, you know, guys that are, I mean, when you look at the ratio, it looks pretty similar in terms of the ACA 19 to 44, 45 to 54, 55 to 64. I'm assuming that those are grouped because they have somewhat similar risk profiles. A 36, a 42-year-old, somewhat similar. That's why you have a breakdown, I'm assuming. And so why it would be so different, like, I would love to see the actual information. You have a lot more women than men. I mean, that may be there, and I'd be curious as to why it is that a group, when you're arbitrarily assigning people to health share or family care, one would end up being, by nature, a healthier category of population. So I'm very curious about that. And because the follow-up question, of course, is
another... It wasn't entirely random assignment.
It wasn't to begin with, but it's random after. Yes, so you followed your provider to begin with, but now it's random, as I understand it. So, you know, maybe by luck of the draw, one got a healthier population than the other, or maybe they are doing things to engage community health care workers and others to keep the populations. Those are the questions that we are trying to figure out without penalizing and cutting people off at the knee. So it is a little hard on the SNF test to look at the enormous, you know, in when health share in one category gets a few cents more, family care gets a few cents more, but in every other category, you know, it's 729 versus 604 for part of the ACA 55 to 64. There's a SNF test here that's you know, questionable in my mind. And on top of that, as Representative Noe said, there are different profit sharing. It's one of the few not-for-profit models. And Chair Greenlick, when you asked all the CCOs to get up and talk about what their models were, I was astounded at how many were for-profits. And then we had one that was being bought by the out-of-state, an out-of-state for-profit holding company or entity that testified this morning, and they're getting an increase. And so to the extent to which you're going beyond doing a total, like, by population gender, I get that. I'd love to see that data. But then when you start going into utilization, how many times, you know, it starts looking like a fee for service, and you get rewarded for higher utilization, which could be a good thing or could be a bad thing. Mm-hmm. So that part makes me nervous. And then if you're starting to do it on how, you know, the degree to which you feel like they're taking Oregon state dollars out of the system, we have to figure out a way that is apples to apples. We talked about that in the earlier hearing today, because some have other entities where they're parking the money, and that is not so visible to us. And so that's of great concern. And if that kind of information is going into the risk analysis, and the question of, we do not want to run ourselves into the ground, we want to make sure that we're reinvesting dollars here, I mean, those are the kind of questions that were brought up that last time. It made me very nervous.
Okay.
So we're happy to provide that detail and briefing, and it would be great if we could do it in the next couple days at your availability.
Okay. Thank you very much. Can we move to the next subtopic?
I did have a correction handed to me that the ACA federal funds dropped to 95% in 2017, and then they go down to 90%. We'll send you the six-year projection, which has those footnotes, and we'll show you where the feds fall off at what percent at what time. Okay.
You have a few minutes more.
So my understanding is that, thank you. This is very, very critical to the ongoing future of the Oregon health system transformation, and we really value your engagement and your keen questions. Thank you. I understand that you wanted to hear about the vision for the Oregon Health Authority and specifically the limited duration.
The issue of balancing them.
Yes. So which would you like to do first?
Let's do the balancing the person.
Okay. So you all have in your packets a chart that looks like this, which shows the limited duration positions. As you know, when I started the Oregon Health Authority, we had more people than we had authorized positions, and we're going immediately took on a truing up of our positions, their classification, the number of people, bottom line, that worked at the Oregon Health Authority. We've completed that work. This chart shows at the bottom of each division the limited duration positions in need of resolution. Our financial team and our chief operating officer are working on a strategy for those positions. You'll see that there are zero in the office of the chief financial officers. There are eight in the office of equity and inclusion, zero in the external relations division, 10 in health systems, 12 in health policy, 20 at the public health department. And so we're well on our way to completing this work. It was very difficult to communicate throughout the process because we were working hard to get accurate numbers. Took us 6 months. We got them. We're clear, and we have a solution on its way. But we're still working through those details with DAS. I don't have a fait accompli to give you today. I just have accurate numbers, which, with all due respect, is a big part of the challenge.
So the resolution, I'm trying to understand the bottom line.
Yes.
Is zero?
Is that what it is, depending on the division. So if you look, for example, at the Equity Office of Equity and Inclusion, we will be seeking eight positions that were originally designated as limited duration positions.
Oh, okay.
They should have been permanent positions.
Position.
They are permanent ongoing jobs, including civil rights investigators and others.
Okay.
But that was the part that we had to sort out.
Thank you.
So one is sorted out, and then eight are not. There's nine total. Eight are in need of resolution. One is resolved. Is that the way to shorten
yes.
that? Sorry to interrupt.
And what about the public health? What does the 60 and the 20 mean?
The public health division, after looking at which of those limited durations end as scheduled, the work ends, the project is ended, et cetera, we still need 20 additional positions in public health to get the right staffing for the work and the right positions in the right classification.
And going forward, you don't need 40 of the 60?
No, no. And that was determined by the public health division after exhaustive review of functions.
I mean, it's interesting. I heard that the director of that division said she was only losing five positions.
It gets very complicated. I'm happy to walk through it, but her bottom line is 20.
20.
Resolution LDs required.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So how many limited duration position people have already left, have been given notice and left?
So they don't, this has been a point of frequent confusion. We did not end any limited durations prematurely, right? So limited durations are usually 18 months mm-hmm. in tenure. Mm-hmm. They were not used that way at the Oregon Health Authority.
Mm-hmm.
But we did not say this is going to end early. All limited durations go for their full contracted period or agreed to period. So.
Okay.
There was a
little confusion. One quick question going back to the executable contracts. Is there a plan B in the event that CMS doesn't, it was testified that.
I'm sorry, could you restate that, Representative Hayden?
Representative Hayden, asking a question here. Going back to the executable contracts with the 60 days notice, it was testified that the CMS approval is running concurrent with the executable contracts that have been sent to the CCOs. What is the plan B if CMS does not approve those?
That is the plan B if CMS does not approve those is to identify in collaboration with CMS if they were not to approve the work we've been doing now, which we have been checking with them on a regular basis. We are in regular communication, exhaustive communication with them. If for any reason they did not approve the rates at this point, we would have a very serious conversation with them about what alternative they would propose, and we would collaborate with them and work with them until we had a solution in hand. But we have been putting exhaustive efforts into not having that occur.
It sounds like you only have about 14 days to do that if that does happen.
That's correct.
Oops.
Okay. So any more questions on the positions on the
limited?
Your
future vision.
Future vision.
Take 5 minutes and share your future vision.
To have a stable, productive, and universally embraced rate process certainly would be one of my key goals. When I took this position on January 29th, I identified the priorities for the Oregon Health Authority for the year. They were quality care for our members. We want to thank the CCOs for helping us to ensure that we have made significant progress there. However, we expect to be improving behavioral health integration and oral health care as well in collaboration with the CCOs. Number two is financial sustainability. We have thrown ourselves at financial sustainability with an intensity that has been urgent, unfortunate, and complex. And it is our goal as an agency to even that out, both through having rates be on a regularly scheduled basis, but also on having clarity for our legislative board of directors as to all the takes and puts for financial sustainability for the Oregon health system transformation. Third was to align ourselves better with the coordinated care organization so we could be faster in our responses to them, so that we could improve billing. And we have done that. We have consolidated DMAP and AMH into one division, and our new division lead, Dr. Varsha Chauhan, begins November 1st leading that division and actually has started work already in her understanding of the system. Finally, our goal was to reduce health disparities. We have lots of progress to make there on all fronts. We have a work plan for doing that, which we are beginning to implement. And finally, a couple of key things that came in that were not expected when we started in January. And one is the regulation and oversight of the medical marijuana program at the Public Health Division. That work is well underway. I'm very happy to tell you that we just hired our team, completed hiring the team you asked us to hire yesterday, and the work is underway in partnership with our Medicaid Advisory Committee and our other partners in doing that work. We are also underway with public health modernization. One of our exciting and really great opportunities in Oregon as we face these other challenges in health system transformation is we know that Oregon is very fortunate to have public health and Medicaid health under one division. Other states have called and said, boy, that would make it a lot easier if we had a correlation and a collaboration between public health for the entire state and for the Medicaid population. Finally, we've talked since January about the March to Kentucky. It's important to note that I have seen the system. We have demonstrated. We've had a presentation to the CCOs and our stakeholders on the one eligibility system. It's not going to address all the challenges we face as a state, but it will address a number of the challenges that have been inordinately frustrating for everyone, including pairing mothers with their newborn children. So that piece of work is underway. I'm happy to talk to you about some of the exciting things we are learning as we get into the behavioral health mapping and visit with people about the opportunities for behavioral health integration into the physical health setting. It does offer us, candidly, an opportunity for further savings and efficiencies while we improve care, and I'm personally very excited about that. And we're also getting a lot of good data on the oral health side, which shows us that there are additional efficiencies and opportunities to improve oral health care for Oregonians before us as well. So with that, I'll stop. I want to express my appreciation both for your tenacity but also for your willingness to lean in. This is the time as we go into Health System Transformation 2.0 where we all need to lean in and find answers to the challenges that we face as a state. The federal government has increasing requirements for us. I do believe it is possible for us to meet those requirements and transform care in a global budget, but it's going to take more engagement, not less. So I encourage you to stay with us in this quest for improved care for Oregonians. Thank you.
Well, we'll save you time on our December agenda.
Day-long hearing.
And in between, if you want to get in touch with any of us, we're all very interested.
Great.
Chair, can I ask one thing?
Yes, one question.
Sorry, I thought we were still in the position, and the LD position. I was going to ask some more questions, and then we went to kind of a wrap-up, so I hate to go back too much. Other than in November, when you come, if you could please let us know how many LD positions were terminated, maybe at the result of a end of their 18 months. I had heard, and maybe that's just the rumor mill, that some people were terminated before the end of that. But I think some of the other questions are like in the radon department where a grant was being expected any day. And so if LD positions are like, this is exactly the length of your contract, and then we let someone go, and then the grant gets renewed a month later, we may lose those people. So having some, you know, I'd love to just hear the thinking, and we can do this offline too, but if you can come back in November, we didn't leave enough time for this particular one, and I know it's caused a lot of heartache. And I just want to make sure that we don't, we need to right size. I agree. We need good functional assessments. Thank you. We need stakeholder input, and I don't know to what degree that happened. But we also need some flexibility in the system so that we don't lose people. And so how you balance all those and what actually happened, I would love to hear from you because, again, we've been hearing from others.
Understood. And I want to be clear, we did lay off 31 management services employees. Those were not the limited duration. So we will bring you the numbers, and I'll make an appointment. We'll get that done. We can easily get that done before November.
Okay.
I do want to note you have 139 vacant positions as of this table in the Public Health Division alone.
I think currently I can get you a current vacancy because we've been, once we knew how many employees we had, we began to fill legitimate vacancies quickly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Close the informational hearing on the Oregon Health Authority. Open an informational hearing on ambulatory surgery centers.
I need to get somebody on the phone.
Okay. The folks who are not on the phone are welcome to join us up here.
Marilyn? Jesse, are your folks here? Okay.
Hello.
Hi, is this Barb Hardys?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, this is Sandy Teeley Circa of the House Health Care Committee. You're on hi, Barb. You're on speakerphone right now?
Yes, ma'am. Can you hear me okay?
I think it's better now. I turned the volume up. Your other panel's coming forward. I don't know where you are at, if we're going to go in order or what, but we're going to begin your topic now. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, my name is Doug Riggs. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center.
Are you the ringleader?
And I'm going to start us out. So, fortunately, we are not here to talk about the Oregon Health Authority's rate-making process for ASCs. That might take a little more time. It was a fascinating hearing we just went through. But I am here to talk about something that we had a brief conversation on in April, and I brought some backup, much more expert witnesses than myself, to go through some details, hopefully to answer some of the questions that have come up during the process, both during the hearing and in the interim. But I did want to give you a little context about what we're talking about. As you recall, House Bill 2570 was introduced by Representative Williamson and others last January and February. We had a hearing in April. That bill would have created a system similar to Colorado's for allowing extended care in the cases of surgery center patients. In Colorado, they allowed for up to 72 hours. The hearing took place, and then the chair directed a group of individuals to sit down in a work session in a work group that we did over about a period of about 4 weeks. The work group discussed through a number of issues that came up during the hearing and otherwise. We agreed in the work group to a framework for a discussion to bring back to the committee, and by the time we did that, it was late in the session and you had CCO hearings, and so this is the follow-up to that work group. You have in your packet, and I won't go into it, what was agreed to in the work group and some details. Obviously, that's a starting point. I know Representative Buehler is talking about looking into potential amendments and where he might want to start at some point as well. But we thought we'd come here today, present some information and answer some questions that had come up. And also we have a witness from Colorado who's got some direct on-the-ground experience in how this works. And so we thought we'd start out maybe with Chris and go from there. And be happy to take any questions along the way.
I understand there is that work group or a work group still meeting?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no, the work group met for about 4 weeks to try to iron out an agreement on those points for the bill and then brought those back to you, and your comment was there wasn't enough time to deal with that.
I thought Representative Bueller still has
something. Representative Bueller is talking about putting a work group together that he will have meeting in the next few weeks, so correct, yeah. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Goggin. My name is Chris Goggin. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. Like Doug said, we are reintroducing the idea of having a concept called an extended stay recovery center. So currently, the ambulatory surgery centers have a license that's it's less than 24 hours, or 23 hours and 59 minutes. What we propose is to have a recovery center that would have a longer period of time, whether it's 48 hours or 72 is to be determined later, but it's an area to enhance the care for patients. It's something that, as of right now, you know, when they get out, they have to go home, that this is an opportunity to have full-time nursing staff as well as an on-call physician that can help enhance the quality of care and make sure that the patient has the optimum outcome that they can possible. And I guess I do want to pass along to Barb, just to kind of give some background. Barb Hardies, who is on the phone right now, is the administrator of a surgery center in Colorado called the Orthopedic Center of the Rockies. It also does have a convalescent care component. They have operated for 15 years, and she can give some background on you know, what she's seen from her facility.
Bones right here.
You want her to start?
Yes, please.
Barb?
Yes.
They're ready for you to begin.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Hi, thank you. Hi, this is Barb from Colorado. I appreciate the opportunity in allowing us to speak this afternoon on behalf of convalescent care centers. As Chris had mentioned, we've had our convalescent care center here in Colorado, Fort Collins, Colorado, for 17 years. We have three ORs and one minor room in our surgery center. And I've been in this position for about 3 years. And what I have noticed over the past 3 years since my arrival is our surgery center and convalescent care center work very closely together. We are an attached unit. Any patient that comes into the surgery center with an anticipated stay in the convalescent care center is carefully screened. Not all patients are good candidates for surgery in an outpatient setting. But once the patient comes through the surgery center, they get a pre-admission assessment, they get education. We do an assortment of procedures here, from total joint procedures to knee scopes to foot and ankle procedures. Patients are discharged from the surgery center. They're admitted over to the convalescent care center, and they stay for anywhere from 1 to 3 nights under 24/7 nursing care. In addition to the nursing care, we also have on-site physical therapy and occupational therapy to assist in getting these patients up to speed with their post-operative recovery, with the main goal of getting them home and getting them back to a good, normal function as quickly as possible. We have a very low infection rate and complication rate, very low patient transfers to the hospitals. We do processes and procedures that are very similar to the hospital, where we have a quality committee, a medical advisory committee, an infection control committee. We process and track a number of quality issues in the center so that we're continually looking and evaluating at what can we do to improve the quality of patient care, medical care, and keep our infection rates low. We also give out patient satisfaction surveys to the patients so that they can give us some feedback on how we're doing, and we incorporate their feedback into our process improvement measures.
Thank
Are you done?
I'm done. If you have any questions for me.
Okay.
This is kind of a broad overview, of a very broad overview of surgery and convalescent care here.
Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Representative Hayden here. You mentioned that you had a very low rate transfer of patients from your convalescent center or surgery centers back to the hospital. What is that?
Patient transfers. Patient transfers are a result of a complication.
What is the percentage? I'm sorry.
Oh, the percentage of complications. Our complication rate year to date, quarter one, quarter two, is 0.002%. And for 2015, we've transferred a total of 3 patients. And our total surgical volume for 2015 so far has been about 2,500 patients.
Thank you.
What's the nature of the surgery on those patients that spend 3 days in the extended care?
The nature of the stay for patients who stay typically a little bit longer, up to 3 days, which is not very often, would be some of our spine patients who have larger spine fusions and our bilateral total knee replacements, or patients who have knees replaced, both knees.
You do bilateral knees and spinal fusions on an ambulatory basis, huh?
I beg your pardon. I did not hear the question.
I was
well.
Just repeating what you said. You do bilateral knees and spinal fusions on an ambulatory basis?
Yes, sir.
Somebody hear that? Okay.
There was a cell phone thing. Somebody buzzed.
Oh, okay.
What percentage of the patients are actually staying in these facilities or combination of facilities over 24 hours?
We have about 25% of our patient population that comes through the surgery center admitted into the recovery center.
They may be one day as well as 2 or 3?
Yes. Actually, our average patient stay 2014 into 2015 has been 1.11 days.
So mostly one day stays, is that what you're saying?
Correct. It's a little over one, correct.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome to stay and listen or go back to work.
Go
back to dinner.
I'd be more than happy to answer. I do have a physician meeting at 5 o'clock. I'd love to stay on the line and listen if I were able.
Was 5 o'clock an hour ago?
No, right now.
5 o'clock
2 minutes.
Is... right now for me. But I'm happy to stay on the line a little longer to answer questions.
No, I
you may have.
I think we're fine. I think you're fine. We're welcome to go on. You don't want to miss a meeting with doctors. That would be terrible.
No, but thank you. I truly appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of convalescent care centers. It's been very successful for us out here, and it has allowed the community an additional access to health care with low cost, high quality. And with our partnership with our local hospital, it has proven to be very successful and positive for the community.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We're going to sign off.
All right. Thank you very much. You have a good rest of your day.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So the purpose of that call was really to show some context on how effective this model can be. If you look overall within the industry, you know, you look at technology, it is improving. Not only the techniques that are being used by the physicians, but the technology itself within an ambulatory surgery center, as well as in the inpatient environment, is improving. We're seeing within the triple aim and the value-based purchasing within Medicare, that's this desire to go to the cost-effective setting while still making sure that there's an optimum outcome for the patient. So essentially what we're asking for is to create this license that can help facilitate that driver and to ensure that patients have the best outcome in the optimum environment. When we look at the private market, we're already seeing these types of trends. In a July 2015 network bulletin from United Healthcare, they are requiring prior authorization for certain procedures at a hospital, and the procedures are listed in the next slide, that actually are not having a prior authorization required in the ambulatory surgery setting. this really reflects the overall desire or the need to be able to push out to the cost-effective setting, where they're encouraging the utilization at an ambulatory surgery setting when it's appropriate for the patient. And so these are just a list of the different procedures that are there. It is a little fuzzy, but again, it's quite a few different procedures, and it's getting more robust by the year. And then when you look at the federal side as well within Medicare, you know, CMS, when they created and opened up to the ambulatory surgery center environment, it was really a policy shift to encourage the most cost-effective setting possible. When you look currently at the Medicare-accredited ambulatory surgery centers nationally, there are 5,300. 1,000 of those also have hospital partnerships associated as well. So when you look at, you know, encouraging the use of an ambulatory surgery center, it may also have things with joint ventures or partnerships with the hospital that the hospital still will be involved, and that they're all making this judgment call to try and find the most cost-effective setting for care.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
No question.
Can you tell me in Oregon what's the average rate of Medicare and Medicaid patients in ambulatory surgical centers?
I wouldn't know that off the top of my head, no.
Maybe if you could send that to me later, that'd be great. Thanks.
I'd be happy to. When you look within the impacts of the Affordable Care Act and the value-based purchasing, this again reflects an overall trend and desire to find the most optimum setting at the most cost-effective parameters. This aligns with the triple aim concepts that are being discussed regularly in the state of Oregon. Even the types of procedures that are being approved by Medicare are expanding. This is a list, and I believe it may even be 11 procedures, but these are 9 procedures that were approved in the Medicare setting to go to an ASC for payment. So we're seeing a trend of this higher acuity of care being done at an ASC safely, effectively, and in a cost-effective manner. We have also seen existing codes being utilized in a greater frequency. Many cardiac procedures are being done at the ambulatory surgery centers as well. Again, being done safely, effectively, with the patient's interests in mind.
Is this being done in Oregon too? Sorry.
Correct. Yeah, these figures are actually done within a center in the Portland area.
So the procedures on the previous slide, those are all being done in Oregon right now?
If I can look into that to give you a definitive answer, I believe that many of those codes are being done. I'm aware of one center in Eugene that was very pleased with the expansion of codes that I would assume would be because they were intending to utilize that.
Okay.
But again, I will follow up with a definitive answer for you, Representative.
Would that then mean that they are being able to provide that under the current 24-hour?
That is correct, yes.
So what is the need for the expansion?
Well, the expansion, again, looking at the patient's interests, you know, sometimes they may not have the family support in the area or people that can help with the recovery. So this is an opportunity for them that maybe it's someone that has a lower threshold for pain or they just don't have family around. This gives them the opportunity to have, you know, full-time RN staff that are able to come in and help make sure that they're having a comfortable experience and an optimum outcome for the procedure itself.
So Colorado testified that 25% of their cases went over the 24-hour limit. And I was going to ask her, but does that mean that
25?
They would...
25%.
It averages 1.1
average,
day.
But that might be because those 25% are like 3 days or something. You said 25%.
She said 25% went over the 24 hours at least.
And then
that's
the average for everyone is 1.1 something.
Yeah. If both those numbers don't go together mathematically.
Well, if it was 26 hours for...
That's 2 days. So if 25% went 2 days, that's a 1.25 average or something?
If they went longer than that, if they went 40 hours, maybe.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee...
Either 1 day, 2 days, or 3 days. It doesn't matter what.
I do have some data that actually comes from her center as well. So my understanding is, yes, of the patient volume, 25% are utilizing the convalescent care component within that facility.
1 day, 2 days, or 3 days. 25% go home directly. I mean, 75% go home directly.
Right.
25% go in, almost all of them for one day. That's correct. The only way to get a 1.1.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Most of them, it's 1.1 days is the duration that they're in this convalescent care or the extended stay recovery center in Colorado. So essentially, if you were to take a knee surgery that's done in Oregon right now, they're doing total joints within about 10 hours. So if you had that recovery of 1.1 days, within 40 hours, they would be going back home. And that would only be the 25% of the people that are even utilizing that extended stay model.
My question is, in Colorado or in Oregon, if we did this, would those cases then not be accepted in the surgery center, or would the patient just rushed through? I mean, I would have a hard time believing that Colorado, if they went back to 24 hours, would cancel 25% of their cases.
And I believe I brought Marilyn Dabrakow that is with Willamette Surgery Center. She can talk about some of the pre-education and some of the things that they can do to walk through that. I don't think they ever rush a patient because I don't think that's really clinically appropriate. But there are ways to ensure within the proper screening to make sure it's the optimum environment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. On the total joint patients.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm Marilyn Dabrakow, nurse administrator at Willamette Surgery Center.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our total joint patients attend a preoperative class with what is termed their coach, whether that's their spouse or friend, whoever's going to be taking care of them afterwards. They're gone. They go through what to expect before surgery, beginning a month out, 2 weeks out, a week before, what to expect the day of surgery, what to expect after surgery, and it includes physical therapy visit preoperatively so that they learn how to ambulate safely at home. And but before they ever even get to that point, the physician has determined if they qualify for this outpatient surgery based on their current health condition and their level of support system that they have after surgery.
Are you done?
Quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know the CARE Act that was passed just a few months ago that requires, I know it's for hospitals, and I'm wondering if it's also for ambulatory surgical centers, that requires some kind of, during discharge, informing a caregiver, a late caregiver, on how to take care of others? Do you know? I wonder if Patty Sullivan knows if they were included in that.
I can look it up
real quick.
Okay. That'd be great.
I'd like to ask you a question. Yes. These are things you're doing now.
Correct.
What would you do differently if you had the ability to stay more than 23:59?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as Chris said earlier, there's many patients who qualify for this outpatient procedures that we do at our surgery center. They just maybe don't have the support system at home. Many of these patients that are getting these higher acuity level of surgeries are younger patients. There's no need for someone who is in pain to not be able to have the active lifestyle that they're used to and have to wait until, say, they're 70. Maybe these patients are 10 or 15 years younger than that. And for that population, many of them still work full-time, and so does their support staff or support people that they'd have at home. And so this would enable the services that we offer to be available to a greater population.
So are you suggesting that it wouldn't change the procedures you did? Do you do bilateral knees now?
We have not done a bilateral knee replacement, no.
Not
at the same time. We have done both knees on patients at the same patient at different times, but not the same day.
The issue that I'm trying to get to is that if you had more than 23:59,
Would you be doing different procedures, or would you simply be doing different patients with the same procedures?
The way I see our current model of healthcare right now, it would be different patients. That's not to say that in the future we wouldn't be doing different procedures. Probably, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, we wouldn't have thought we would be doing total joint patients and them going home the same day. So healthcare is changing, and we want to have the framework in place to be able to accommodate that.
I hear a question down here. John was
in. So I'm trying to, and I want to talk just a little bit about the 24 hours, because you made a comment about, so they come in for surgery, and so they might be in the surgery center, so they have the prep, the time to get ready for the surgery, so they might be in there multiple hours. None of those multiple hours count to the 24
hours.
Yeah,
they do.
They do count
to the 24. If they put them in at 6 a.m., they need to be out by 6 a.m. the next morning.
The next morning. So from a standpoint of staffing and openness, so if they come in and it's 24 hours, but 24 hours goes over, so in theory they could spend the night. So you have to already have been staffed up for them to do that. Because I'm trying to understand, if we go to 72 hours or 48 hours, whatever it is there additional cost? Because if it's only used 1.0 whatever the percent is, doesn't that drive the cost up to be staffed up to do that while they're still not staying that length of time? But I guess I'm trying to understand that connection, because the argument here is to be more efficient, cost efficient in that, which I appreciate. But if we move to a model where they can stay longer, go ahead. I mean, can you?
Yep. Thank you, Chair. Representative Lively, that's a great question. And it may drive up. That's just all part of the business decision. So many times how they would design the surgical day, mm-hmm. that they would go in, and if you had an extended stay recovery option, they're going to plan those surgeries out. So the ambulatory surgery center may be in operation, you know, at 7 a.m. They admit the patient. They go through, do the surgery. They're discharged at 3 p.m. That ASC may shut down at 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. And then they can open up the convalescent care component at 2:30, be able to do the screening to operate from there.
Oh, okay.
Right now, the Colorado model has a different facility, right? I mean, there's the ambulatory care center sitting here. And the extended care center is
separate,
next door, over a bridge, across the street, something like that. Right now, most of the surgery centers here just do the post-surgical stay in the same facility. I mean, at least the one I visited the other day was.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Some ambulatory surgery centers also will have a deal at a hotel where the patient may go and stay at the hotel that's nearby. And so really, I think the advantage of having an extended stay recovery center is that you're making sure that it's a cleaner environment. You know, they're going through the same procedures. To answer your question, there are separate, the ambulatory surgery center and the convalescent care center in Colorado are distinguishable and separate, but it's a single application that you submit within the public health department. They may even have a single ownership umbrella from them. So although they may have different governance and policies and distinguishable from their operation as a business, they are still very well affiliated, and most of the time they are just separated by a firewall between the two centers themselves.
Well, why couldn't you use an existing SNF that way?
I think it may be within the...
Because you need 3 days of hospitalization to qualify for Medicare funding.
That's a good question.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my understanding is that many of those SNFs that you're referring to are for longer-term patients that would need, that take up the bed space longer than what these patients would, and there often isn't a bed available for someone to stay just one day or...
Okay.
Mr. Chair, may I address the committee?
Please.
My name is Jesse Arambidi. I'm the administrator at Oregon Outpatient Surgery Center in the Tigard area. And the one thing that I believe that will impact this decision is that there's more patients that will be able to be done in the surgery center setting that typically right now, my center, Maryland Center, the center that you visited, we have to restrict the kind of patient that can come there. They have to meet certain patient criteria. So anyone who may have a health condition or any type of problem that would we would typically right now say no to, those are the patients that are going into the higher care setting, such as a hospital. So it would open up our ability to see patients that typically we would refuse at this point. Yes.
May I, Mr. Chair?
Please.
So are you then going to have to staff more like a hospital? Because in part, my thinking would be is that you're not able to see those kind of patients because the risk is high and a hospital has staff or equipment or rooms set up to deal with that. And I thought this was more about people who need longer time to recover. These surgeries are maybe could be done elsewhere. They're not likely to need a long inpatient stay. They don't usually. So that to me sounds like, no, you want to be more like a hospital.
No, typically those patients are pretty predictable. If we know now that the patients that we're seeing for total joints are going to be going home, they qualify for our center, they qualify under our program, we know that they're going to be going home. If you took that patient that maybe has a little bit more higher of a risk, then yes, you do. And typically centers that I've seen across the country, they'll staff for it. They'll say, you know, Wednesday, we have two patients. They're going to be spending the night. We will be staffing the convalescent center for that or overnight stay. We're staffing for it now. We know that, okay, this patient is most likely going to be going home, but just in case they can't, we typically staff right now for it. So we're basically, if the issue is cost, we're paying for that now.
Okay.
So I did want to show a couple of the examples of data from this is from the center in Northern Colorado that Barb works at. When you look at the average reimbursement for a knee or a hip replacement that's done there, it is considerably lower than the regional hospitals there. And she is the facility is in partnership with the hospital, so they do have an interest in her facility as well. But again, their goal is to have the most cost-effective setting possible. When you look at the quality measures.
Can I see that again?
Will
you go back?
Yes, sir.
Is Kaiser running an ambulatory surgery center as well on their own? Is that why their rate is so low?
Yes, Mr. Chair. They actually have two ambulatory surgery
centers. They have their
own.
They're running their own ambulatory surgery centers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, may I make another comment?
Yes.
Along with this, the patients that are going to the hospital, if they have a 80-20 plan, that portion of the 20% is coming out of their pocket. Same thing if they were to go to the surgery center, 20% of what that reimbursement would be would also come out of pocket. That's another reason that patients do choose surgery centers, because their out-of-pocket cost is also a lot less.
Thank you. Go ahead. I think we need to wrap up shortly, but go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So as Barb had indicated, you know, the infection rates are considerably low for the volume that they do, as well as the complication rates. Within being transferred to the hospital, it's only, you know, a handful out of 1,000 that tend to really end up in that aspect. And the satisfaction is exceptionally high. When you look at, you know, high 90%, that really is exceptional when you're looking at patient care. So what we are asking for is to create a similar type of model that we see in Colorado. This is a very robust regulatory structure to ensure that the quality and the architecture is sufficient to be, you know, in the interests of the patient. We do not really foresee having a dramatic change in the utilization between hospitals and ASCs, although there will be that shift going on, you know, overall within a higher acuity of care naturally. when you look at the fact that the convalescent care model has been existing in Colorado for 20 years, there are only 12 convalescent care licenses out of the total of 123 in the state. So, you know, really, if you look at that, if there's 104 in Oregon, we'd probably only expect to see about 10. And I would likely to, I would correlate that to your spine procedures and your orthopedics as well. You know, you won't see someone that's just doing eye procedures. They likely won't be interested in putting the capital investment for this type of model. And really, the whole concept here is to try and promote the triple aim. We want to increase access to care, make sure that it's high quality of care for patients, and that it's at the lowest cost possible. Thank you for your time. I appreciate
it. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. We'll expect to see a bill. I know I talked to Representative Bueller, who couldn't be here today because he's wasting his time celebrating his 25th wedding anniversary somewhere. Seems a strange priority. So. I know he has a group meeting and they expect to have a bill for us at some point, so we'll hear about it again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to close the public, the informational hearing on ambulatory surgery centers and open up a hearing for an update on the health insurance marketplace. Very quiet talking about the marketplace nowadays compared to the way it used to be.
We're not used to being the least interesting thing on the agenda.
We're glad.
Controversial.
Yeah, that's right. I was in an emergency room not too long ago, and I was being ignored by the doctor, and I was waiting there hours waiting for the doctor to come, and they said, in the emergency department, being ignored is a great sign. So that you're boring today is good.
We are going to be terribly boring, and we only have good news, which is always what we're here to talk about. So good afternoon. My name is Barry Leslie, and I am the administrator of the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace, which is now part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And with me today is...
I'm Joel Metlin. I work on communications and outreach for the marketplace.
I send my regrets for Director Pat Allen, who normally likes to appear before you on this topic. He is or was invited to appear before the Congressional Oversight Committee on Investigations and Oversight. It's a big, long, fancy title. I think that might have been his reaction.
That's a bad sign.
It was on, and he's speaking to the history of Cover Oregon. And so I guess I can certainly say with confidence that he would rather be here with you today. And so he absolutely says
he was invited, not subpoenaed. So
that was the second option, right? Right, exactly. So really, in all seriousness, I really do only have good news to share with you today. And the first most important piece of good news is that we made it through the transition of Senate Bill 1. As you know, in March, DCBS was given the task to dissolve Cover Oregon, to stand up a new marketplace at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and, oh, by the way, also prepare for open enrollment, which begins November 1st. And so it's been exciting and brisk times at DCBS, but things are actually going amazingly well. Really pleased to report to you that the marketplace is up and running and doing well, still providing local support and outreach and education to Oregonians and making sure that they have access to high quality and affordable health insurance. We ended the last open enrollment period with about 107,000 people enrolled in the marketplace, and that number has stayed relatively steady over time. So that's really good news. Another really piece of good news is that Oregon's uninsured rate has fallen, according to the Department of Health and Human Services, from about 15% in 2013 to about 8% in 2015. So that obviously is in part due to Medicaid expansion, but that joint effort has really done good things for Oregon. So that's great to be here to tell you about today. The next... 8%. Obviously, there's a lot of work up ahead. As I mentioned earlier, we have open enrollment around the corner November 1st through January 31st of 2016. And our two main priorities for open enrollment this year are trying to retain as many of those 107,000 people who are on the marketplace, who we believe are still eligible to purchase insurance. And then a second population...
Do they need to re-enroll? I thought this time they didn't need to.
Actually, our message for folks is take action. Take action, take action. Regardless of your circumstances, regardless of what you think you're supposed to do, go to healthcare.gov and check what your circumstance is. And we feel like if we stay really consistent with that message rather than getting into different scenarios, that really will help encourage people to go in and verify their information and make sure they're getting the best plan for them.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's fine. So the second thing, our second priority for open enrollment is to target the folks that we believe are could be shopping on the marketplace and are eligible for subsidies, and that's something in the range of 85 to 105,000 people. And so that's our second area of high priority. And we're using the data that we've collected to do a very targeted outreach campaign to find those folks. Obviously, our resources for outreach are much smaller than Cover Oregon's were, and so we really need to be thoughtful and intentional about targeting that outreach and then measuring its effectiveness to make sure that we change it if it's not reaching the audience that we need. So that's what open enrollment will look like this year. Last piece of good news is that we still have an incredibly competitive marketplace. We have 11 medical carriers offering something like 120 health plans to Oregonians, which is a wonderful opportunity for Oregonians. But it also means that we have to be really intentional about providing local support and help to folks so that when they are shopping, they have people to help them figure out the best plan for them, because health insurance can be complicated and it can be confusing. So that completes all of my good news, and I know we're probably running way over, so I'm trying to be brief, but just be glad to answer any questions.
You're doing fine. Come in early.
Okay.
You know, we want to make sure we had time for questions.
Chair Greenlick, we want to answer any and all of your questions.
Great. Well, let me start. I'm interested in the table that you have. Do we all have it based on the poverty level? We heard a startling number at the basic health plan work group, whatever it's called, that 80% or 90% were under 200% of the poverty. I mean, I think that number was wrong. This looks like 57% roughly are above 200%.
Chair Greenlick, that is right. And it looks like you're focusing on the second page where you see marketplace enrollment by income level, and that certainly answers that question.
That's good. And 15% or more are over 300%?
Yeah.
They're in the marketplace without subsidy, is that?
Yeah.
Remember right? Is that over 300?
Are you still on the second graph on the second page?
I'm on a table that looks like this.
Okay. You know what, actually, we brought, and I apologize, I thought you already had it because you were, I brought something to pass out. It's kind of a little extra special because we knew you were interested in numbers. May I approach the committee assistant?
Yes.
To hand this out?
This is a very clear table that distributes the population of enrollees by the proportion of the poverty limit.
And is this one? He has an earlier version of.
Okay, perfect. So you're looking at...
I think everybody has this one.
They do. And Chair Greenlick, when we heard that you were interested in numbers, and this having access to this kind of data has really been wonderful, because when we took over the program in July, we were all asking each other, what does this population look like? And if we can't figure out what they look like, how can we target them with this very small amount of money? And so although the data is not ours... So we can't necessarily control it or always do a great job explaining how the folks who put it together came up with it. We are able to use it to really help refine our outreach efforts and just our general understanding of the marketplace. So what we did when we found out Friday that you were interested in some of this information or just a global look at the marketplace is put this together over the weekend. And I'll email this to Sandy, so that you have it in writing.
Can you just run over it for us, roughly?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to do that. Because this has been hugely helpful for us to have this information. So on the first page, what you're looking at there is that essentially the world of folks that are eligible for qualified health plans and subsidies. So that's kind of what we look at as our total customer base. And that's just really helpful for us to know the world in which we can operate. And then if you turn over to the second page, what you're seeing is Oregonians who are actually subsidy eligible.
Wait a minute, let's go back. Hold on. We've got time. Let's look at these numbers if you want.
Sure. There. Absolutely.
There are three categories here. Is that right?
Yeah.
So the one...
Can you explain the categories? I don't know what these mean.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Noss, absolutely glad to do that. So the 107,000 is the number I enrolled to earlier, and that's the periwinkle or purple, and that's 107,000 enrolled inside the marketplace. And then you have, as somebody called it, cranberry earlier today, and that's the 116,000 enrolled outside the marketplace in grandfathered and transitional plans. And as you know, this year folks have to shop for other ACA-approved plans this year. So
they're going to go somewhere else, that 115,000.
Does that mean they didn't use the marketplace at all?
6,000.
You're talking about
That's the 26,000. Thank you.
The 132,000 are people that use the marketplace but were not eligible for subsidy or are totally independent?
That's the next chart.
Oh.
Yeah, we're just talking right now about people that qualify for qualified health plans. So that's anybody that could use the marketplace, whether they get subsidies or not. So subsidies is a smaller subset of this larger number.
Okay.
So this includes people who could use the marketplace because it offers a wide selection of plans, but they may not qualify for any subsidies.
The 107 may or may not qualify.
107 are currently using the marketplace who are QHP
but
eligible.
But could be above or below 400.
Yeah.
Percent.
Yeah.
Okay, can you explain?
No, the 107, he's talking about the green 107, I think. Yeah. The 107,363.
That is enrolled in outside of the marketplace. So, again, like any of these
in marketplace plans.
Yeah, they're in ACA-compliant plans, right. Not necessarily in marketplace. So you can see that it's about 107 outside and 107 inside the marketplace. Now, again, each one of those, there's going to be a subset of people who are eligible for subsidies. Mm. So that we're talking about two different parts of the pie here, the total pie.
So it's 107 in green, even if they're eligible so for subsidies, don't get them, is that right?
Correct, because they're buying outside the marketplace.
So is that just me? If I just call up Kaiser at random and I don't use your exchange, but I just call them up and say, "Hey, I'd like to have health insurance," and they say, "Sure."
Yeah.
And wouldn't they direct me back to the marketplace maybe and say no because you could get
no,
a subsidy?
No, not necessarily. There's cases where if you know that you're not going to be eligible for the subsidy, you make over a certain amount, you may not want to deal with the marketplace. You may want to just buy like your plan, just go back and buy it again. Situations where people would want to do that.
And this does not include employer-based healthcare. This is just individuals.
Correct. This is just the people that are eligible for the marketplace. So if you had employer coverage, you wouldn't be eligible.
Okay.
So I'm tracking now.
Next page.
So this is really the chart that tells us what Oregonians are eligible for the subsidies. And you have 83,000 folks who are currently subsidy eligible who have insurance in the marketplace. So that means that 83,000 of our 107,000 total customers are actually receiving subsidies right now. Then you have the 40,000.
Also means that 24,000 are in the marketplace but are not receiving subsidies, right? Mm-hmm.
Chair Greenlick, exactly. Yes.
And they're not receiving they're not eligible. I just want to make sure it's not because they didn't ask. It's because they're not eligible for the subsidies, even though they enrolled.
Well, to be eligible for certain types of subsidies, like the cost share reduction, you have to buy a silver level plan. So if they bought something other than that, they might not be getting that subsidy. And that's an important group.
They would be getting a premium subsidy anyway.
What's that?
Right. They'd be getting a subsidy on the premium.
Correct.
Right.
But not on the cost share.
Right.
So then we go to the 40,000 who are subsidy eligible outside the marketplace, and that's one of the groups that I mentioned that we're really prioritizing in terms of trying to target our outreach to, because obviously, given that affordability is always the number one concern for Oregonians in purchasing health insurance, knowing that you might be subsidy eligible, something you definitely want to check. And then we have the 93,000 that we've come to find out are subsidy eligible and currently uninsured. And so that's another key audience that we're focusing on during this open enrollment period.
So those two make up the 105,000 people you're targeting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or about,
The 105 number is a little bit smaller because some of these people are only going to be eligible for a small amount. It'll be hard to get them. So we're really focusing on those people that would make a significant difference to them.
Sure.
Right. So then, Chair Greenlick, as you referenced earlier, we have the marketplace enrollment by income level, which really, for us, we use this to really help figure out what income level are we already successfully targeting, and then what income level are we not doing as good of a job at targeting. And so, again, that really helps to inform outreach and education that we do.
Hey, is that right? 57%, I think I calculate, are over 200%. This is an important discussion because the question, if we do the basic health plan, The question is, how badly would it destabilize the market? Because what population would be under 200%?
Go to the next page. You see it. It's fascinating.
It's really an important issue.
You would know how you're doing if you knew what percentage of people were in that category.
Right.
It might be that more people are in the category of 150 to 200% to begin with, since that's your biggest category. Like, to know how well you're doing, you'd also want to know what percentage of our population is in each of those FPLs.
Hmm. Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Guy, that's absolutely right. That's a very, very good point. So then turning over the page, we have the marketplace and off-exchange enrollment by carrier. And this is just very straightforward. Obviously, it tells you how many folks are enrolled both through the marketplace and also not through the marketplace by carrier.
This is fascinating.
Yes.
Nobody's buying the Platinum plan except Health Republic. That's so interesting.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Nose, this is a lot to take into for the first time that you're seeing it. The good news is that Senate Bill 1 requires us to be here every time you meet. And so, and it really is, frankly, Joel and I joke that, you know, we don't get invited to a lot of cocktail parties to talk about these issues. So it is great to hear your feedback and to see that it's interesting to you as well, because it's certainly of great interest to us. And then lastly, as Representative Nose mentioned, you have the marketplace enrollment by metal tiers. And so that really tells you where consumers are focusing their dollars.
Mr. Chair, if I may, so your comment earlier and Kenny Guyer's comment about basic health, I mean, you know, you can see where if we did that, which I kind of want to, you know, you could see where I'm making an assumption that those folks are probably concentrated in bronze and silver plans, unfortunately. I can't prove that, but that's my hunch.
Depends on the subsidy level.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're only subsidizing the premium, right?
So no, it's subsidizing mm-hmm. premium and at low levels, it subsidizes premium and the cost share.
Cost share. Do they really?
Yeah, we reduce the cost share, like if it was $2,000 deductible. You get the right subsidies, that might go down
maybe
to
750. All right, so then if I did not understand that, so maybe that's why very few people are choosing the Platinum plan then, because if you're getting subsidized for your cost share in addition to your premium, then yeah, why not choose a bronze or a silver plan then, because you're going to come out ahead.
Is that only the silver plan, though?
Correct. It's only the silver level that you can get the cost share reduction.
That's why so many people are in that category.
But you create a sort of pseudo gold by doing that.
Correct. Right.
Okay. I mean, that's your point. You create a higher level plan in terms of the effectiveness.
And Chair Greenlick, Representative Nose, that's another major message that we're taking to the streets this open enrollment period, is that ask about cost share reductions. And we're partnering with lots of agents and other folks who do kind of community assistance work in this area to make sure that they're helping consumers remember to ask about cost sharing reductions. So
can I comment again?
You can.
I'm embarrassed that I just now learned that, actually, because I feel like that's a pretty important piece of the legislation I did not know about. I mean, that's a pretty, because as a union person, I bargain benefits, and we kind of criticize the silver plans because people look at the premium, but then if they get sick, they don't really have any coverage. That's been our critique, but actually what I'm hearing is, no, they don't pay those ridiculous out-of-pocket costs or those deductibles. They get help.
Some.
Well, they pay some, but not as much as it's advertised. So, that also, why buy the Platinum plan? You don't need to.
Not a lot of people do.
Right.
It goes back to, they have to fit the category from an income standpoint to do that. But
those
in here
are.
Well,
only 899 of them. And they're all buying it from Health Republic.
Those are the people in the marketplace, though. Those are the people in the marketplace who probably are there because they get subsidies, so that would direct them toward the silver plan. People not on the marketplace, I'm guessing a higher percentage of those might be the gold and platinum.
But these are marketplace.
That's true. These numbers are only marketplace.
They're only the marketplace.
Right.
Oh, you're suggesting that the people buying outside the marketplace might.
Because they're not getting the subsidies.
Might be tilted towards high.
Okay. Sure.
High premium plans. That's possible.
So,
okay.
Chair,
can I ask you another question?
Please.
Tell us about where we're going with SHOP.
Thank you very much for the question. So, Chair Greenlick, we put out an RFI, a request for information, earlier this year, just to really gather information from vendors. A lot has changed in the last 3 years to really better understand what the world of opportunity looks like for SHOP out there. We also began talking to small business owners.
This is small business.
Oh, small health small options business. Program. Thank
what's
you.
Health
options program. Small health options program. And just really beginning that conversation with the business about what would you like this to look like? What's important to you? How can we create a system that's successful and actually bring you to use it? And we collected a lot of great information with that request for information, but of course didn't get the information about costs that we'd hoped for. So we're currently working on a request for a proposal to put out later this year to actually be able to gather that information as well, so that we have the full picture to show to this group and others about what the costs would be to Oregon and kind of what the services and features would be offered. So that RFP will be issued in 2015.
And the implementation date for CHOP for having people, I'm confused, I guess, of whether they have to participate or not after a certain date.
No, they don't have to.
They don't have to participate.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively, they don't have to participate, and we have been working with our partners at CMS to bring about this opportunity for Oregon by 2017.
Let me tell you my fantasy. I live a rich fantasy life sometimes, and this fantasy came from hearing hours of testimony from small businessmen and women. What they wanted, they supported the exchange very, very strongly. We had great business support. That's because their vision was that they could move from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan. And right now they were struggling, the 50% that were providing health insurance were struggling with brokers and figure out Sadie wants one thing and John wants something else. They were going crazy over that. Their vision was they could come to the marketplace and say, I want to put $200 a month into my employees' health insurance. I have 10 employees. Here's my $2,000 check. Let them go figure out what they want and pay whatever difference it is. That's what the small business people that testified envisioned. Is there any chance we'll get anything like that?
Chair Greenlick, I really don't know right now. I think that's a great question, and that's been certainly echoed in the conversations we've had with small businesses. I think what you're expressing, though, is really important in that when we do deliver SHOP, we want it to be representative of what people really want and need versus just a program to fulfill a mandate or a requirement. And so that's why we're probably taking a bit more time than we'd like to, but we're actually really wanting to get it right and make sure it's a meaningful program.
You think it would be technically feasible to do something like I described? Is that something that could conceivably
Chair Greenlick,
happen?
I work so hard not to answer questions about technology. I just, I honestly don't know. We're way outside of my.
It is a technology question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's illegal. It's a question of does law allow? I mean, I don't think the ACA. I mean, otherwise, a lot of employers would probably do that. They'd just say. That's what they're doing with retirement. They're saying, we're not going to manage your pension anymore. Here's $1,000 a year.
That's right.
Go invest. Good luck. Now, for healthcare, that might be a better model because it's not about investment and can you manage your money. Well, I don't know. I should be careful. I might not agree with that.
Wow, you might learn something at your job over time.
What you do then is say, we're going to bargain to make sure we have enough money allocated to cover a platinum plan that covers premium and has, you know, you could go that direction.
Yeah, but the problem is that small businesses aren't dealing with labor unions. They're dealing with what I do with my 10 employees.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they've been trying to do good. That's the point. I mean, they want to
keep trying to do good. Well, those employees could say, you know what, instead of giving us a big raise this year,
give
us more money toward our health insurance. Or,
they could.
You know, I mean.
They could. Yeah, go from 200 to 250 next year.
You have Hayden and Kai there.
All right, guys, let's go.
Go ahead.
Who's first?
So, Chair Greenlink, and the question under the ACHA, Affordable Care Act, Health saving plans are part of that program, and they are allowed under the program, but my current understanding is that they're not available under the marketplace. Why could not those be part of the marketplace, and then Greenleck's fantasy would come true in the fact that the small employer could buy a health savings plan for their employees at their $200 a month and then let the employee contribute whatever wasn't additionally covered by subsidies? Why isn't that part of the equation, since it's part of the Affordable Care Act?
Chair Greenleck, Vice Chair Hayden, that is not something we've contemplated yet at all. And that's a really interesting question, and I look forward to gathering more information and getting back to you about that. That's it.
The real question is, would they get their subsidy?
That's the question.
Right.
Under the Affordable Care Act, it looks like they would if you actually read that document, which is not very exciting to read.
Mr. Kenny Geyer?
I have a couple questions about the charts. The one about marketplace enrollment by metal tier. HealthNet and Trillium have zero, so I assume they're participating and no one signed up?
Correct.
Or did they? That's it. Okay. So eventually, do they still keep offering? Because at some point, we were also contemplating, is it too confusing? We have too many different carriers with too many different plans, and there was some discussion about maybe we need to narrow it down. Where is that discussion, and are these two going to just offer again and see if anyone takes it?
Chair Greenleck, Representative Kenny Geyer, it's a great question, and it's one we struggle with a lot. And how do you provide choice and options in a wonderful competitive market, but also make sure you're not overly confusing people?
Yeah.
I think that's Director Allen's been really clear with me on, transition, get open enrollment, make it successful, and then we'll start thinking about how does this, what's our next step? What's the next step for the Oregon marketplace? Because it's really important. It's actually been quite successful, as you noted from the statistics I shared earlier. But I think that's the next conversation. That's why it's great to hear your questions today, because we've also been wondering those things, but not sure yet where we're going to take it and collectively where you folks would like to go.
So a couple more questions.
Sure.
Chair, thank you. So the financial sustainability, where is that $107,000 compared to what you need to be for long-term sustainability? Are you on, this is fine?
Chair Greenleck, Representative Kenny Geyer, we are financially sustainable. We actually did not assume any of the residual grant money from Cover Oregon. Mm-hmm. And I think we have been working to close those out just to make it kind of a clean end date. So we do bring in enough money from our assessment revenue to pay for our current operations. We know that the federal government is going to begin charging for the federal technology in 2017. So we've been thinking about that and preparing for it and, in negotiations with them about how much that will cost. And so that's a great unknown. But we are financially sustainable just with those assessment dollars.
So presumably, not knowing how much they're going to be charging you, you're going to need to still increase some to make sure that you can cover your costs?
Chair Greenleck, Representative Kenny Geyer, it really depends on how efficient we can be with our current budget, too. Even with your household budget, you have braces or something coming up 2 to 3 years from now, and you kind of look at your existing operations and think, what can we do differently? Are there other things we can do? So there's lots of things we're thinking about in terms of how to pay for that cost. But until we know what it is, it's all conjecture.
Okay. Two more, Chair. Okay.
Tell us you're not planning on creating not your own entry system, right? Please assure us of that.
Chair Greenleck, Representative Kenny Geyer, you saw my earlier answer to your very easy technology question. So that is certainly not in my plans. I think we all know that what's best for Oregonians right now is to continue with the system that did work well during the last open enrollment period and which they're comfortable with and that we actually have gotten relatively good feedback about. So right now, that's our focus, is to keep that system in place for Oregonians.
Another two questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So advanced premium tax credits was a big headache last time around because there was a technological snafu. How are you feeling about that right now? Does it look like you've calculated the tax credits accurately? And
so Chair Greenleck, Representative Kenny Geyer, and Joel will check me on this. That's all done at the federal level.
Uh-huh.
So what you heard about last time was
our own problem.
Okay. So we just simply don't have responsibility for whether or not that's a problem. And wasn't a problem during the 2015 plan year open enrollment. So we believe that issue's buttoned up.
So my last question, thank you, Mr. Chair. You were saying you'd love to hear what our questions are for next time.
Absolutely.
What would be really great is where you have the income level, if you could tell us what percentage, you know, so it's 30% right now of your population is that you've captured is between 150 and 200. You know, what is the population of eligible? I'm talking about eligible because, like, the five-year bar people aren't eligible, et cetera. So of the eligible population that's up to 400%, what are their numbers? So we can see whether we're over or underrepresented in certain categories. And the same with ethnicity. It would be really great to know how the population for people that would be eligible for the marketplace. So again, individuals who are eligible, not five-year bar.
Couldn't the five-year bar people be eligible, just not for subsidies?
Yeah.
They can purchase in the marketplace, can't
they? Well, they can just call up and buy it, right? I mean, they'd be in that other, this other group, who just like, I want health insurance.
That's true. So it almost deserves a number on its own that I don't know to call them out, in part because we're trying to figure out the basic health plan. So that's part of my reason for doing that. And the other is that, you know, part of the big idea behind this was contracting out with community agencies that could really go out and do the cross-cultural outreach to make sure that we target different populations. And so it's hard to know from this how good a job we're doing, and we might need to tweak it and put more emphasis in that area if we're very few Latinos compared with the number out there that are eligible are signing up, then maybe we want to do a big outreach in that area.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Koenig, I couldn't agree more, and we will absolutely return with that data. And it's been really important to us to partner with the organizations in Oregon who are already doing this work, specifically across the kind of broad demographic, so that we are making those resources available and also just learning more about those communities that we should be providing a resource to. So be excited to tell you more about that next time as well, because presumably we'll have more stories and information to share after open enrollment starts.
Thank you.
I also got had an urban legend come true today when I got a letter from a person who said she's disabled and finally able to get health care under Medicare. Some friends of hers are in the exchange and got health insurance, and then she has some friends who are in Medicaid, and they're not being treated right, and I want the government to stay out of our health care.
Well, okay. It's like the poster, I'm moving to Canada if Obamacare passes. Remember that one?
Did you move? That was good.
I'm not. It was the poster. There was a guy that said, I'm moving to Canada if Obamacare passes. And the irony of that was, of course, they have universal health care.
That's right. The government. I'm going to close this hearing and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pat we'd rather have you than him anyway. Because you know something.